Had I faced Brock Lesnar right now in that ring, I would be standing there being hailed as the Beast Master.
He was Lord and Master over all beasts. He was the Beast Master.
Beast Master? You realize how stupid you sound?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the streak!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat! Delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Do you believe they made a Beastmaster Part 2? I had no idea there was a Beastmaster Part 1 until Jinder Mahal said that stupid line on SmackDown, and it got me searching around to see what a Beastmaster even was. And then I saw they made a movie by the same name in the early 80s. I'm actually genuinely surprised I never saw this movie before. Anyway, this is episode 523 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, November 26, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. I hope everybody had a happy Turkey Day. I realized the other day that we are a little more than a month away from Wrestle Kingdom at the Tokyo Dome, January 4th. You know who's looking forward to that show? This guy. This guy right here is looking forward to it. Thank you to our partners at Audible, audible.com, for being a great partner throughout the year. And thank you to everybody who has used our link to sign up for the 30-day Audible trial. You get to sample the service for a month without getting billed. If you like it, you can continue on and start a monthly membership. But if you don't, you get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep regardless of whether you stick with it or not. I don't know why you wouldn't take advantage of this, so if you haven't already done so, there is still time this year to get in on this deal. It's pretty badass. Just use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. The link is always the same. You can use it if you think there's somebody else you know, a family member or a friend who might be able to take advantage of it. By all means, pass it along. Lots of wrestling books up there, including the Justin Roberts book, Best Seat in the House, Slobberknocker, the Jim Ross book, which is in fact narrated by JR himself, Daniel Bryan's book, Bob Holly's book, Brock Lesnar, Shawn Michaels. I mean, you've got this wrestling library to choose from. The Death of WCW is always a fun recommendation. Depressing, but fun. So please use our link if you are interested in trying this out, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Also, our annual Black Friday sale on Pro Wrestling Tees is still ongoing as I record this. If you're listening to this on Sunday or Monday, it runs through tomorrow, Monday, November 27th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. So you have most of the day on Monday still to cash in on this deal, 20% off all shirts in our Sound Off store through this sale. I just use the coupon code Black Friday. That's all one word, Black Friday, at checkout. You can get yourself 20% off all Sound Off shirts. There's over 30 in that store right now to choose from, so head on over there and take advantage of the Black Friday sale. I guess on Monday it would be Cyber Monday. We can call it the Cyber Monday sale. I'm waiting for the year where they come up with some kind of gimmick for Tuesday, and then Wednesday, and then Thursday, and it's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And hopefully nobody got caught up in the whole hoopla of Black Friday. Nobody got dragged out by their girlfriend or anything, or their wife, to go shopping in person. You could do all your Black Friday shopping online. I'm not really sure why you would want to go to the store. But if you are a black belt, perhaps, or you have some judo skills, or if you're in a state that's an open carry state, so if you live in Texas or something, and you feel safe enough, then by all means, venture out on Black Friday and try to get $9 off or whatever it is these stupid deals are. Anyway, thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation to the show. I appreciate the hell out of you guys. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here at the top of the show. You can go to thesolomonster.com. We got about a month left here in the year, and this has been our best year yet in so many ways, and so many new listeners and people who want to contribute, whether it's PayPal or t-shirts or just spreading the word or whatever. So if you want to contribute, if you want to make a donation to the show, you can certainly do so. We got a month left. Hoping to end the year on a strong note. Thank you to John Luis Cannon Lopez, as always, buddy, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, the Florida Freebird Brian Pissera, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, the God of Justice Giovanni Turner, the Show Off Corey Van Dam, the Chin Crusher Karsten Axe, Stephen Foulmouth Fowler, Life of Luxury Daniel Chin, John More Money More Problems Morin, Dark Sky Dixon Krasinski, Fred the Shed Carter, Nova Scotia Nitro Spencer Black, and Clayton Creepy Uncle Van Kockenstein, which is one of my new favorite donators, so thank you, Clayton. And last but not least here, the Nomad, Damon Chan. Evolve 96 is coming to the Elm Corps Center in Queens, New York, Saturday, December 9th. Keith Lee defends his WWN title against Walter. Matt Riddle takes on Fred Yehi in a no-ropes-break match, or no-rope-break, I should say. That's going to be interesting. Evolve champion Zack Sabre Jr. battles DJZ, and NXT Commissioner William Regal will be in the house. He'll be doing photos and autographs, and the rumor is that he may be on hand with a major announcement to make on that Evolve show. So you can order tickets right now on Ticketfly.com. Save 10% when you use the code EVOLVENOW. That's EVOLVENOW, all one word. Last night was Starrcade from the Greensboro Coliseum. You didn't see it unless you were there because it did not air on the WWE Network. Not sure why, but cutting costs left and right, and I guess the expense was just too much, so they decided not to air it live. But just some of the quick results here. We had Bobby Roode beating Dolph Ziggler, and they had Arn Anderson, one of the founding members of the Four Horsemen. In fact, it was, I think, Arn who's credited with coming up kind of on a whim during a promo segment back in the studio days with the Horseman name, and it kind of stuck, and they became, you know, probably the greatest wrestling faction of all time. And so Arn was out there as the enforcer, appropriately enough. And this video of it, you know, they put a lot of video clips of all these matches up on the WWE YouTube channel, which again begs the question of why they didn't just air it. But anyway, Ziggler took a shot at Arn. He slugged him right in the face outside the ring and knocked him down. Arn, of course, wasn't going to take that lying down. He got back in the ring. He ended up giving Dolph the Spine Buster, still the best Spine Buster in the business, from Arn Anderson. And Bobby Roode won with the glorious DDT. And then after the match, Arn got on the mic. He got up in Ziggler's face, who was laid out on the mat, and he said, "Welcome to Horseman Country." And the crowd popped. That was a big moment. I know Bobby Roode was very excited that he got to share the ring with Arn Anderson, so that was cool. Another cool moment, Dustin Rhodes was there, obviously the son of the American Dream, the founding father, I guess, of Starrcade, if you will, and Dustin was out there dressed up as Dustin Rhodes. He came out to the old Dustin Rhodes theme song that he used in WCW. He was billed as the natural Dustin Rhodes. He beat Dash Wilder with the running bulldog, and it was funny, there's this great, like, three-minute interview, I guess you'd call it, backstage after the match with Dustin. Gets very emotional talking about his dad and what it meant to be back in Greensboro and to wrestle at a Starrcade show. And he says, you know, "I even came out to the old natural theme song," and he completely buries the music. He's like, "It's an awful, terrible song, but that's what I used to come out to, so I had to come out to it." So we all know what he thinks of that theme song. The Hardy Boys were there, including Jeff, who's recovering from surgery. And the Hardys were there with the New Day and the Rock and Roll Express. Now, originally, I think when they made this card, it was going to be the Rock and Roll Express wrestling a match against Anderson and Gallows, and somewhere in the last week or so, that got changed. I don't even think Anderson and Gallows were on the show. I guess they wouldn't be, because really, it was a SmackDown show, so I don't know why Anderson and Gallows would have been there anyway. But they had a little dance-off with the New Day and the Hardys and the Rock and Roll Express before the team started to come out for a fatal four-way match, Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. The New Day, Benjamin and Gable, and the Usos. The Usos, of course, picked up the win. It wouldn't be a Starrcade show in Greensboro without the Nature Boy Ric Flair. So Flair came out to cut a promo before the live crowd, before Charlotte's match. That was very appropriate to have him there in attendance. And Charlotte beat Natalya. It was the first ever women's cage match in the Carolinas. And Charlotte retained her SmackDown Women's Championship, and then celebrated with her dad after the match. And AJ Styles, to end the show, beat the Beastmaster in a cage match to retain his WWE title. So, yeah, look, it's a glorified house show, but they had some special gimmicks and attractions that were, you know, special to the live crowd there in Greensboro. I still think it would have been a nice thing. First Starrcade show in, what, 20 years or almost 20 years? It would have been nice to put something like that on the network. And hopefully in the future when they do things like this, they will make the effort to put that on the network. I think that's what the network is for, right? I mean, you're not going to air house shows live every week, but when you have a special show like that, you should give people paying money for the network the benefit of being able to see it. And you can cut all the bells and whistles. I saw it. It was a very basic setup, like the entranceway. The only special thing was they had the Starrcade ring skirts that they had specially made. It doesn't have to be some type of like really elaborate setup. You can have the one camera and just film the show, old school. So anyway, that was the rundown for Starrcade last night. Forgot to mention before, if you missed it, you can download the show that I did with Wade Keller. Wade had me back on his Podcast One show on Wednesday this past week, which I'm grateful for. I'm always appreciative when I hear that a lot of people downloaded the show and tuned in, and he has me back on. So if you missed the show, we talked about the fallout from Survivor Series. We talked about SmackDown Live from this past week, which I'll also talk about here in a little bit. And we answered mailbag questions. Somebody actually wrote into Wade's show for me, with a buy or sell question, which was kind of funny. So if you missed it, it's the show from Wednesday. You can go on podcast1.com. It's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. You could download the show from there. And the more people who listen and the more people who download, the more likely it is that I'll be back on the show in the future. So head on over there and check it out. If you want my full thoughts on Survivor Series, I'm going to give you the Cliff Notes version here. But if you want the full review over 40 minutes, it's up on our YouTube channel. It's the Sound Off Extra for Survivor Series 2017. We've got just about 110,000 plus views on that video so far, and we broke 30,000 subs on the YouTube channel this week, so I am grateful to everybody who continues to show their support on the channel. I think it's pretty cool for a channel that really houses only bonus content to have that type of to have that type of subscriber base, and also to get the traffic that we get on a lot of these videos is very happy. It makes me very happy. So check the video out. It's up on there again. All the thoughts on Survivor Series, the good, the bad, mostly good. But we'll break it down on there. Final poll results, by the way, almost 4,000 votes on Twitter for Survivor Series. 76% thumbs up, 24% thumbs down. That's a thumbs up show right there. I went 8 for 8 in my Survivor Series predictions. Doesn't get much better than that. It was the tale of two cities with those two main events. AJ Styles and Brock Lesnar was everything that I wanted that match to be going in. And the men's elimination match to end the show was everything that I did not want it to be. It was frustrating, it was confusing at times, and it was ultimately disappointing. I think it was the visual sort of, looking back on it, of seeing Nakamura and Bobby Roode and Samoa Joe and Finn Balor sort of picked off one by one. It was like a sniper taking them out one after the other, only to leave Shane McMahon and Triple H and Kurt Angle and John Cena and Randy Orton. That, to me, is everything that is wrong with this company in a nutshell. Thankfully, there's Braun Strowman, who they did manage to keep him in there until the end. They managed to keep him looking strong, although he was as confused as anybody at the end of that match. The Styles-Lesnar match, I think, with the Shield New Day match and the Usos against the Bar, made this an easy thumbs-up show overall, despite the very lame way that it finished. Kurt Angle, by the way, he did a Q&A on his Facebook page and said the reason his leg was taped up so heavily, because he came out and his leg was all wrapped up. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, my God, I mean, this guy's only... He wrestled the TLC, and I think he wrestled like a tag match on the European tour. And already this guy is all mummified. His leg is all wrapped up. And he says the reason was because he tore a muscle in his leg doing wind sprints 2 days before the pay-per-view. And he says, no big deal, it should be okay in a week. That does sound like something that Kurt Angle would say. Eh, give it a week. It'll be just like new. You know what? For his sake, I hope it is. I hope it is, because Kurt seems to be in a pretty good place in his life right now. And I would hate, I really would hate to see him sort of overexert himself or get wrapped up in this Hulk comeback thing and they start giving him more matches and he hurts himself. You know, I don't want to see the guy go through any sort of major injury or anything like that. So hopefully he knows enough to take care of himself. I mentioned Triple H. Dave Bautista was on the Ross Report this past week, and I love listening to Dave. He's a humble guy. He's very honest. I mean, sometimes Bautista in these interviews, he is brutally honest, and I like that about him. It's one of the things I like about Bret Hart. You know, Bret Hart, here in his older age, can come off as very cranky. I don't know if that's just... I think that's just Bret, honestly. I mean, I don't really think you can just call it age or the stroke or anything like that. I do sometimes wonder if that had something to do with him just not giving a fuck and just being brutally honest in a lot of the interviews that he's done over the years. But I also think a lot of it is just Bret being Bret, but that's one of the things I like about him. And Batista's kind of similar in that he's not beholden to anybody. So he's in a good place in his life and his career outside of wrestling. And so, you know, he's not worried about pissing people off. He's not worried about offending people. He does these interviews. Like I said, he comes off as a very humble, very nice guy, and just very, very honest. You don't have to agree with everything he says, but it's one of the things I appreciate about him. And I'm really happy for all the success that he's having. I mean, he's not quite on the level of The Rock, but could I see him getting, you know, closer to that level one day? Yeah, I could. He's actually not a bad actor. He really isn't. And actually, I'm about to watch this movie called Bushwick that he just did. It was just added to Netflix, so I'm hoping to check it out maybe this week. It's about a military invasion here in Brooklyn, which sounds like a completely random concept for a movie. So, anyway, I'm a fan of Big Dave. He was on JR's podcast. He said he's had talks with Vince McMahon about coming back to WWE, but he has made it very clear to Vince McMahon, and probably Triple H, and just the powers that be, that he is not interested in a one-off appearance. He is not one of these guys that wants to come back and get the one big pop at WrestleMania, and have the one match, get the big payday, and then disappear. He actually is, he's the polar opposite. He hates that. He has no interest in that whatsoever. If he comes back at all, he wants all in. He wants to be on TV every single week, you know, part of like a storyline. He wants to work house shows, which is not uncommon. I mean, I've heard people like Chris Jericho, and he's made the occasional comebacks in the past only to do house shows. If you've ever been to a WWE house show, you know exactly what these guys are talking about. You know exactly where they're coming from. You can tell they're just having more fun out there because they don't have the constraints of being on TV. You only have so many minutes. Vince is watching on headset in the back. You're getting your cues, your time cues from the referee. You don't have to worry about that. And plus, the house shows is where you can go. You can try out new things. And so, generally, I think, you know, the guys have a lot more fun. So I can see why Batista would want to work shows like that. He loves wrestling. You listen to this guy talk, he genuinely loves wrestling. You know, for all the success he's having in Hollywood right now, he's one of these guys that has not forgotten where he's from. And like The Rock, he loves coming back because it's who he is, you know, it's in his blood. It helped kind of make him a star, it gave him that platform to go on to do things in the movie world. So he wants to work a program with Triple H. That's really what he wants. And in past interviews, I've heard him call it like a retirement program. I don't think he used the word retirement on JR's show, but I have heard him refer to it as like a retirement program, one last program. And he wants Triple H to be the guy that he works with. And I guess he wants Triple H to be the one to retire him. And he said that he's really not interested in working with up-and-coming guys, only that he would want to build to whatever it is that he does with Triple H. I would love to see Batista back on WWE TV. I think he got a raw deal when he came back last time. He won the Royal Rumble. The timing was just all wrong. It was the wave of Daniel Bryan support, and he just got... He was an innocent bystander. He really was. It was like a stray bullet hit this guy right in the head. It wasn't anything that he did wrong. It was just wrong place, wrong time, and he got hit by the stray bullet called Daniel Bryan. Now, I would love to see him come back, but not to wrestle Triple H. You know, he said every time he's brought the idea up to Vince or Triple H himself, he gets like a meh, we'll see type of reaction. Like they're not interested in it. And I got to tell you, I'm siding with WWE on this one. Like that match does not excite me at all. Like, those two had the perfect story in early 05. The way they very, very subtly built that story up when Batista was still in Evolution, late 04 into early 05, it was this just organic support that they allowed to bubble up where the people wanted to see this guy break away and they wanted to see this guy beat Triple H and become the world champion. So whatever plans they had for Triple H and Randy Orton at WrestleMania that year in 05... they saw what was going on with Batista. And now Orton, I mean, Triple H did Orton no favors. I mean, for a while, there were people saying, like, you know, you were Ortoned. It became like a phrase that people would use when Triple H would sort of knock people off their pedestal because of what he did to Randy Orton. Randy Orton won the world title from Benoit at SummerSlam in 04, dropped it right back to Triple H the very next month, and didn't do Randy Orton any favors. Fast forward to the Rumble in 05. I think that was where he and Orton had their match that was originally pegged for WrestleMania. They did it at the Rumble instead, and Orton was concussed. They were doing this weird angle where Randy Orton just kept getting concussed. Like, they would never in a million years do that angle today. But it was like, man, they really, like, you know, they brought this guy down a few notches. But it was Batista who the fans really got behind. That was great. But that was also 12 years ago, going on almost 13 years ago. I don't need to see that again. I don't see there being any story that they could develop that would be as compelling to me as the one that we got already in 05. And why try to redo something if you can't top the original? Why would you go and do something again when you know that it's going to be inferior to the original? Doesn't make sense. So as a match, it just doesn't excite me at all. But, you know, and if that's the match that Batista wants, then maybe it's better that he just keeps killing it in Hollywood and just doing his thing there. You know, to me, Batista against Samoa Joe, Batista against Braun Strowman, Batista against Brock Lesnar. Those are all matches that I would like to see. Those are all matches that I've never seen before. And actually, when Batista came back that first time, people wanted to see him and Lesnar. I think there was one TV segment where they were in the ring together and people were sort of buzzing about it, but we never did get that match. I wouldn't mind seeing that match one time. I don't know if it'd be any good. You know, you put Brock in there with an AJ Styles, he has a great match. You put Brock in there with Braun Strowman, it wasn't so great. What are you going to get with a guy, almost 50-year-old Batista, who hasn't wrestled in a long time, getting thrown around by Brock Lesnar? I don't know what kind of match that would be, but I'd like to see it at least once. So those are all matches that I'd like to see. And preferably, I would love to see the old Hollywood Batista. I was very entertained by him when he was doing that thing. I think we were deprived of Hollywood Batista. He wasn't around for very long. It's kind of like Hollywood Rock. Hollywood Rock is my favorite incarnation of The Rock. When you look back, we only got it for like 2 or 3 months. I mean, we should have gotten that for a good 6 months to a year. So it was kind of the same thing with Hollywood Batista when he came out as like the, you know, like this douchebag in a black vest, and you know, he was healing on John Cena, kissing fat women and babies and all that. Like, that's the Batista that I would love to go back and see. I don't think we'll ever get that again. But Batista against Triple H again, especially if it's only about him coming back to lose to Triple H, sort of the way Sting in his first WrestleMania match, his one and only WrestleMania match, came in to lose, of all people, to Triple H. No, thank you. I'm not interested in that. Speaking of things I have no interest in seeing, Jerry Lawler was on his podcast, Dinner with the King, and he relayed a story about The Undertaker at Survivor Series this year. He says he saw the dead man backstage and that he looked too good, in his words, not to have another match. He said after WrestleMania this year, he thought that we had seen the last of The Undertaker, as most of us thought. He says, now I'm going back on my word, and that just looking at him the other night, I think there's some more matches left in The Undertaker. This is according to Jerry Lawler. He also, by the way, on the show shared a cool little story about being in the back, watching on a monitor, sitting next to Undertaker and Kane. So you've got the three of them, these three legends, sitting in the back watching the show. And all of a sudden, John Cena comes walking by, like through a doorway. And he stops himself, and he backs up, and he looks at them. He looks at the three of them sitting there, and he just says, that's pretty cool. And then he keeps walking. So that's cool. What's not so cool is all of this talk about The Undertaker wrestling another match. If you remember the promo battles with John Cena and Roman Reigns from a few months ago when Cena made the comment about Undertaker being a battered veteran at the end of his career with a bad hip, it was almost like a passing comment, but it came across as very... like in character, it came across as being very disrespectful. Like, perhaps, as I thought, it was a little seed being planted in the event that they wanted to finally do the Undertaker-John Cena match at WrestleMania that we never got. Any talk of Undertaker coming back for one more match, which happens around this time every single year. I talk about it, everybody talks about it, okay? I recognize that. We go through this every single year. But any talk about it now... if he was going to come back for a match, to me, it has to center around John Cena. I mean, who else would even make sense for him to wrestle at this point? Especially if Roman Reigns is already, you know, booked with Brock Lesnar, so he's already occupied. Now, who else is there? But after this year's WrestleMania, I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it because he didn't look good this year. He's not going to look any better next year. I hate seeing him as a shell of what he once was. That, and also, I think the way they handled the post-match with him leaving his shit in the ring and then disappearing, you know, being lowered down to hell in a puff of smoke, and then the lights go out and they fade to black, that is as fitting a way for that Undertaker character to go out as you could come up with. And I hate the idea that he either comes back and loses again, or he wins, but he wins in a bad match, which would make John Cena look bad. Because if Undertaker goes out there and it's not his best night, and, you know, he beats John Cena in a bad match, I just don't see what good that does either guy. It's just not something that I think should happen. And that's a match I wanted to see, by the way. I mean, the time to do that match was when the streak was still a thing. And John Cena, you know, to his credit, we see him losing more now, I feel like, than he wins. I don't really think you can sort of lob that criticism anymore at John Cena. You could at one time. I mean, people love to lob that now at Roman Reigns, and I don't even really know that it applies to Roman Reigns either as much as it used to. It's not like these guys are unbeaten and nobody's ever beaten them before. But there was a period of time when John Cena was the invincible Superman, John Cena, and Undertaker had this streak. And it was a big match between two big names, two guys that had not wrestled each other since probably 2003 or something, in a singles match anyway. And there was a time at WrestleMania, maybe going back to like WrestleMania 29 or WrestleMania 30, where that would have been a huge match. And you would have had the drama of the near fall with, you know, Cena hitting an AA or three AAs or locking Undertaker in the STF and Undertaker threatening to tap, and people would have been losing their shit at the thought that John Cena, of all people, would end the streak. They probably would have been ready to storm the ring. So that would have been the time to do it. But even after the streak, I still felt this could be a big match. WrestleMania 31, 32, you could still do it. And then I saw him again at 33 this year, and I said, no mas. No mas. And then he lost. And then they did the post-match stuff, and I said, well, that's it. Like, you know, I'm not convinced that he's not coming back, but he really shouldn't, you know. And so anyway, I hope he stays retired. I know the likelihood of that probably is slim. We're already hearing from people like Lawler saying, oh, he looks so good. He could go another match or two. We're already hearing this. And in fact, I think that they're going to set up whatever his WrestleMania match is, whether it's Cena or whoever it may be, I think they're going to set it up when he shows up at the 25th anniversary of Raw in January, because they've already announced The Undertaker will be on that show. I don't know if he'll be at the Barclays Center or if he'll be in the smaller Manhattan Center. My guess is he'll be in the Barclays Center. I don't see them doing the big elaborate Undertaker entrance in, you know, the big grand ballroom upstairs that barely fits 1,000 people. I think if you bought tickets to be at the Manhattan Center and those tickets sold out like that, it was because you want the nostalgia and everything, and so they knew those tickets were going to sell out no matter what. But I think you probably bought those tickets, if you are going to that show, at the expense of seeing The Undertaker live, because I have a funny feeling he'll be popping up in the Barclays Center. But I don't just see him coming out to just say hi and then leaving. I think they're going to set up whatever he's going to do for WrestleMania. And to me, John Cena probably would be the one who would make the most sense, but I just wish they would leave well enough alone. The tentative schedule of WWE pay-per-views for 2018 was revealed originally by PW Insider this week. They are reducing the number of shows to 14. By my count, that's down from 16 this year, so it's not a huge drop, but thank God it's a drop nonetheless. I mean, the fewer pay-per-views, the better. I have felt like there have just been too many of them for so long. And so 14 is better than 16. Not going to complain. That includes 5 Raw pay-per-views, 4 SmackDown pay-per-views, and 5 co-branded shows, this time including Money in the Bank, which is funny because I've been saying this for a while now. And I give them a lot of credit for making Survivor Series interesting this year. It really has not been one of the big 4 shows in a very long time. This year it felt like one of the quote-unquote big 4. Before this year, it hasn't felt that way in a long time. The big 4, really, for the last few years, has been Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, Money in the Bank, and SummerSlam. Money in the Bank should have been a co-branded show from the start. It was weird that it was, I think a SmackDown-only show this year? Now, hopefully, what I'm hoping, and they haven't specified, but I'm hoping it's just going to be one mixed-brand men's Money in the Bank match that has a combination of Raw and SmackDown talent, and then one mixed-brand women's match with women from both Raw and SmackDown. We do not need more than 2 Money in the Bank matches on one show. We sure as hell don't need 4 in one show. And so, aside from that, it's all the usual shows. When you look at the schedule here, it's all the usual shows that you would expect, except for there being no Great Balls of Fire. That looks like one and done. Just like that Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view they once did. I was at that show, by the way. It wasn't very good. That's why they never did another one of them. Also, Pro Wrestling Sheet is reporting that WWE is in talks with Facebook to produce yet another weekly show, this one to air on Facebook Live. The show would debut in January, and it would go live on Facebook immediately following SmackDown Live, which means that 205 Live... Oh, live. Everything's live. Live, live, live. So after SmackDown Live, it would air, which means that 205 Live would no longer air live after SmackDown. I sound like, you know when Michael Cole says WWE? Sometimes Michael Cole, it's like he has a malfunction, and maybe his battery pack starts to like short circuit or something, and he'll say WWE, like in the span of 30 seconds, he'll say those initials like 10 times, right? So he'll be like, welcome to WWE Raw, and tonight the WWE Championship will be on the line, and you can go on the WWE Twitter page, or WWE.com, and you can leave comments here from the universe about what you thought of tonight's WWE Champion. And I'm like, dude, like, someone's gotta calm this guy down. Like, he's seriously losing his mind. And it's so grating on the nerves. So now I'm doing the same thing here by saying live over and over again. It's so important to this company that things be live now and not taped, even though I don't think it really makes that big of a difference. But I'm sure people who live in other countries who have been spoiled many times over the years would probably disagree with me on that. But I don't know if they would just tape 205 Live before SmackDown and air it after the show, but then they would literally be competing against themselves. So I can't see them doing that. I don't know what their plan is, but as for the new show, and this is again according to Pro Wrestling Sheet and what they've been told, it would probably include stars from both Raw and SmackDown. It would be a mixed brand show. Some sort of mixed tag team concept has been pitched, pairing off men and women. It almost sounds to me like a game show. I don't think it is a game show, but that was the first thought that I had when I heard about this concept. This mix-match thing. It sounded like a game show concept to me. The first thing I thought of were those old MTV Road Rules Real World Challenge shows. I don't know if they still do those anymore. But if it was something like that, I would be down for that. I mean, one of the things that we really haven't seen with the network, all this original programming and the documentaries and Table for Three. I love all that stuff. But we don't have any sort of like game show. And I do think that there's an audience for that. Now, I remember hearing that R-Truth shot a pilot, some kind of game show pilot for the network, and then it got axed. I think this was right around the time that the budget cuts started happening and the pyro disappeared and all that. So I have no idea what the concept of that would have been. But I'm down for some sort of like game show type thing. I have no interest in another wrestling show. I feel like we get so much of that from them already. But whatever this Facebook thing is, I doubt that I'm the target audience for it. So I guess what I think doesn't matter. But a game show concept I think would be fun. I still get a kick at going back and watching those old Silent Library episodes on YouTube that MTV did with the WWE stars. They did at least one, if not a couple of those Silent Library shows. And it had like lower level guys at the time, like Dolph Ziggler. I think Trent Barreto was in there. Kurt Hawkins and JTG. And you can find it on YouTube. It's an interesting concept. I thought it was funny. I wouldn't mind seeing something like that on the network. Let's talk about Raw from this past week in Houston, Texas. Over 2,300 of you voted. 56% thumbs up, 44% thumbs down. Finn Balor. Finn Balor was a hot topic of discussion coming out of this show. One, because he got choked out by Samoa Joe. And two, because of a report that originated from Dave Meltzer after the show, who claimed that plans for the Royal Rumble have changed. And Finn Balor, who was originally pegged for a Universal title match against Brock Lesnar, is now out. And he is out because Vince McMahon, allegedly, does not believe that Balor is over enough to be in that spot. Now, I can believe that the match was changed because Vince McMahon changes his mind more than he changes his socks. Him not being over enough, that's a crock of shit. Not saying he doesn't believe it. I can totally see him thinking that. I mean, who knew? Who knew that a dull feud with Bray Wyatt and a random loss to Kane on television would make the guy less over in the eyes of the owner of the company? Who can fathom such a thing? I know, it's preposterous, right? Killed by Kane, and then the next week, tombstoned by Kane, and left for dead. And you know what made that so much worse? Was how much of an afterthought Balor was treated like after that spot. Kane literally walked out, tombstoned this man on stage, and then very calmly walked to the ring for the next match. No revenge, not even a hint at any desire for retribution for what Kane did to him since then. Nothing. And yet, at Survivor Series last weekend, what got one of the biggest reactions of that main event? Finn Balor and Shinsuke Nakamura tagging into the match at the same time. I'll be honest with you, I don't even know why it got such a big reaction. I mean, I could see why people might have been excited to see the two of them, I guess, step into the ring together for the first time on the main roster. They had one match, I think, in NXT. But this was like a big reaction in Houston when those two stepped in the ring. It kind of caught me by surprise. And so it's funny, like, again, if Meltzer is to be believed, it's funny to me that the very next day, after that spot, after that little interaction between the two of them, that's the day that Vince McMahon decides, you know what? This guy's not over enough. We have to change plans. That just sounds like one of the most Vince McMahon things that Vince McMahon has ever done. And it's just bizarre to me, you know, looking back, that they would put this guy over AJ Styles at TLC, only to do what they did the next night with Kane. And then it was AJ who's the one who goes on to win a world title a couple of weeks later. It's like, none of that makes any sense to me at all. Now, for his part, Balor has been trolling these reports on social media. He had one post where he posted a picture of himself with a turkey on Thanksgiving with a message that read, "I am not over, ... cooking the turkey." So he's having fun with this. Is he having fun because he knows it's bullshit and they're just sort of mocking these reports? Or is he just having fun with it because he thinks it's nonsense that he's not over? I don't know. It looks like he's poking fun at the news. He's taking it in stride. I'm not convinced, honestly, that the reason the match was changed, if it was because Vince doesn't think he's over enough. In fact, WWE is running a poll right now on their website about who people think deserve the next shot at Brock Lesnar's championship. And among all of the big names on Raw that are listed here in this poll, Balor is running away with the vote. 67% last time I checked. It might be higher by now, because I checked it last night. 67% of the vote. Now, I know it's not a scientific poll. Perhaps there was a little bit of stuffing at the ballot box going on in light of this news. That is possible. But believe me, the guy is popular enough to warrant a one-off match with Brock Lesnar. I'm not talking about an extended program. I'm not even saying Finn Balor should beat Brock Lesnar or could believably beat Brock Lesnar. I'm not saying any of that. We're talking about a one-off match, a speed bump for Brock Lesnar on the road to WrestleMania. Yes, I believe Finn Balor is perfectly suitable for that spot. You know, whatever Vince's rationale is for changing his plans, if you're a Finn Balor fan, the one thing is, like, the silver lining in all this is that it spares him from a guaranteed loss, because he wasn't beating Brock, okay? He was not winning that Universal title. They would have done with him exactly what they did with Joe. They would do with him what they did with AJ, put on a good little show, and then lose to set up Brock for his big boy match with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. But of all the available names, you know, that's the match I was hoping to see. Balor still has not gotten his rematch. He still has not gotten a proper rematch for the Universal title since he came back, the championship that he never lost. He was never pinned for it. Plus, you've got Paul Heyman on TV name-dropping Balor. He's done this a couple of different times now. He's name-dropping Finn Balor. He's praising him. He's going out of his way to mention Finn Balor by name. It sure looked like that was the direction. Now, maybe they're just trying to protect the demon character, you know? Maybe that's what they're doing here. Maybe it's not so much, the guy's not over. They just don't want to beat the demon. But it doesn't have to be the demon against the beast. I mean, even though that match kind of sells itself, right, in the advertising, right? The demon and the beast. But it doesn't have to. He doesn't have to put the paint on for this match. It could have just been Finn Balor against Brock Lesnar. You know, Balor has a good showing like AJ did, and he ends up coming out of the match strong in defeat. You know, I definitely would have preferred that match to the one that I've seen floating around online this week, and I don't know where this originated from. This could be complete bullshit. I have not seen any sort of reputable website report this yet, so I put that out there, but I've seen enough of this that it's starting to get me a little bit worried. I've seen the name John Cena floated around as Brock Lesnar's opponent for the Royal Rumble. You know, it was bad enough seeing Cena do absolutely nothing at Survivor Series to warrant him even being in the match, let alone him being built up for a Universal title match. Okay, I mean, just think about it. What a way to start 2018 that would be. With John Cena challenging for the championship. You know what? If they really are that desperate for an opponent, if they are now without an opponent for Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble, or if they are just planning on going with the tried and true John Cena, who is a big star, don't get me wrong, he is still a big name, okay, but we've been there, done that. If they really don't have any better ideas for what this guy should be doing at the Rumble, I'll tell you what, and some of you are going to scoff, and I really don't give a fuck, I still like my idea from a few years ago of Cesaro challenging him in a one-off match at the Royal Rumble. And I know, again, some people are going to say, Solomon Monster, Cesaro's a tag team wrestler now. Why would he all of a sudden challenge for the Universal Championship? Because who the hell cares? He's already beaten everybody there is to beat. He beat Ambrose. He beat Cena. He beat Joe. He pinned Reigns in the Fatal 4-Way at SummerSlam. He beat Strowman. He beat Styles. If not Balor, why not Cesaro? If they have no opponent for Brock and they need to kill time before the match with Roman at Mania, then why not have Heyman come out one week and sort of announce this Brock Lesnar Invitational? It could be a tournament. It could be a one-night battle royal on TV. You know, Heyman's out there. He claims the Beast ducks no challenge. This is too easy. We're on the road to WrestleMania. Brock wants competition. Whatever. However you want to handle it, however you want to get to that point. And then in a shock move, you have Cesaro get the win. Absolutely nobody would see it coming. I don't think the fans would mind it at all. I actually think it would get a great reaction. It's a match we haven't seen before. There's only so many of those that you can believably have, right? You're not going to put Brock in there against, Apollo Crews. So, you kind of check all the boxes off here. You can check all the boxes off with Cesaro. Plus, you know, it's rare that Brock gets in there with someone of equal or greater strength. Tell me it would not be fun to see Cesaro throwing Brock Lesnar around instead of it just being the other way around. It's not very often we get to see that. And if this report is wrong, and Vince McMahon does not actually believe that Finn Balor is not over enough for the match, and they're doing it just to protect him, let's say, then what the hell do you have to lose by going with a guy like Cesaro at the Royal Rumble? If you remember, the reason I pitched this match for the Rumble in, I want to say it would have been 2015, I think it might have been, that I was pitching it for, was because the Rumble pay-per-view is always sold on one match. The Royal Rumble is sold on the Royal Rumble match. That's what that show is all about. You can have a strong title match just to add to it, but the people who love the Royal Rumble, it's their favorite show all year. It's not their favorite show all year because of what the championship match might be. It's their favorite show because of the 30-man Rumble match. That's what sells that show. You could get away with doing a title match that is perceived as being weaker. Plus, back when I pitched it, you had an actual storyline reason to do it when Heyman was still managing Cesaro. And I know that turned into a whole waste of time. But you could have built a story around Cesaro wanting to challenge Lesnar for the championship. He splits from Heyman, comes this close to winning, but in the end he gets beaten. Now, you no longer have that association with Heyman and Cesaro, but you could do the invitational concept. Anybody can win the chance to battle the Beast. I started thinking about Cesaro again as a singles after he jammed his teeth up into his skull and still went on to wrestle a 4-star match, and everybody was talking about, man, they should be doing more with this guy. What a beast this guy is. Yeah, he is a beast. And now I'd like to see him wrestle the Beast. Balor and Joe had a real good match on this show that ended with Joe locking in the choke and Balor passed out. They followed up the Triple H Braun Strowman stuff from Survivor Series by having Kurt Angle come out and tell Triple H that this is the Olympic gold medalist talking right now, not the Raw GM. And if you ever try anything like that again on me, I'm coming for you. So the tease for Angle and Triple H at WrestleMania continues. Jason Jordan came out. He started talking crap to Triple H. He wanted a match with him, and Triple H looked like he was going to oblige when all of a sudden Braun Strowman came out. And he stared down Triple H until Hunter very slowly backed out of the ring. Very impressive how Triple H wins the match at Survivor Series for Team Raw. And here on this show, he is now feuding with not one, not two, but three different people. It's all about the game. Just like the theme song says, it's all about the game. Stephanie then made a match between Braun Strowman and Jason Jordan, who is so obviously going heel. I mean, they could not make it any more obvious if they tried. To make this guy any more of a, just an annoying douchebag. He went on to go to Kurt backstage, go to Daddy, claiming that his leg, which he had said was 100% healed, all of a sudden, oh, my leg hurts, it's giving me problems, and he's begging Kurt to cancel this match, doing everything he could to back out of his guaranteed demise. And he kept calling him the monster among men. Like, he had all of these backstage segments. Jordan even went to Matt Hardy for advice at one point because, you know, Strowman had destroyed Matt Hardy a bunch of weeks ago. And every single segment backstage with this freaking guy, the monster among men, he's the monster among men. And look, I get that that's the nickname they use for this guy. I understand that, but you need to watch these segments and just the way in which they script these mentions into these segments, they sound so phony. I cringed so hard I thought I may have torn something. Imagine during the Attitude Era, okay? And I go back to that just because people look at that as the greatest eras of all time, most exciting, most fun. Okay, let's go back to the Attitude Era just for a second, okay? Triple H. Visualize Triple H backstage trying to back out of a match with Steve Austin by saying over and over, but Vince, he's the Texas Rattlesnake. Don't put me in a match with the bionic redneck. or trying to beg out of a match with Kane by calling him the devil's favorite demon. Vince, you can't do this. You can't put me in the ring with this guy. He's the devil's favorite demon. Oh no. You know how ridiculous that sounds? Remember Sting? The Vigilante. Remember the Vigilante Sting? What the fuck? What was that all about? Why couldn't he just be Sting? Why couldn't he just be the Icon? Why do you have to come up with a ridiculous name for the guy? The Vigilante, like he's fucking Charles Bronson in Death Wish. Tonight, I step into that ring against the Vigilante. Do you think wrestling... This is an honest-to-God question. Do you think that wrestling would have been half as cool as it was back then if those guys had the same scripted dialogue that these guys do? I mean, it's a rhetorical question. I already know the answer. But it's a question worth asking. The answer is no. So I feel bad for these guys. Because you know these guys know that this is just shit. Some of these lines and some of these things that they're forced to say and the buzzwords and all that is complete garbage. And they know that. And yet they have no choice. They have to go out there and they have to say it. And I feel bad for them. Jordan did come out to wrestle Braun, but it did not go very long before Kane returned from his hole in the ring and he attacked Strowman. He posted him, chair to throat, and Strowman was struggling to breathe. He was wheezing. He was coughing all the way back. He left on his own power, but he was coughing and wheezing all the way to the back. He looked like he was having an asthma attack. I would, you know what? I would like, now, it's obvious that this is going to a resolution. They're going to have a match. The first time they were going to have a match on Raw, the bell never rang. So they technically still have not wrestled a match. So they're going to have a match whether you like it or not. And, you know, I want to see Braun get his revenge and win and just be done with this. I would like to see a buried alive match to end this feud. I have always had a soft spot for that stipulation. I don't know why. Just brawling to the grave and having to dig the dirt and everything. I always liked that. I always liked that concept. So I would like to see them end this, not with a cage match, because we've already seen that a bunch of times, right? We saw it with Braun and Big Show. I feel like we've seen a lot of cage matches recently. Enough with the cage. Enough with the shark tanks. Enough with the cage. We get it. I don't need to see a Ring of Fire match or anything like that, and I don't see them doing like an Inferno match or anything, and plus Inferno matches suck. They just do. So I like the buried alive stipulation. I wouldn't mind seeing that kind of, you know, dug up, no pun intended, as a way to end this feud. All you got to do is just dig Bray Wyatt out of the grave first and then, you know, just use it for a match between Braun and Kane. Kurt Angle ordered a fatal four-way match with Bayley, Sasha Banks, Alicia Fox, and Mickie James to determine the next challenge for Alexa Bliss. Because of course they did, right? They are so devoid of ideas on what to do with these women. Let's just have another fatal four-way. This, when this year is over, this will go down as the year of the Fatal 4-Way and the Fatal 5-Way. I have seen so many Fatal 4-Ways and 5-Ways with these women. I never in a million years thought that I would actually be turned off by seeing a 5-Way between 5 beautiful women. But somehow, WWE has managed to actually do that, and they have completely turned me off from these matches altogether. Because there's just so many of them. There's no more one-on-ones, there's no more personal issue between two women, it's just, we don't know what to do with them, and so let's just shove them all in a match together. And it's not just a Raw thing, it's a Raw thing and a SmackDown thing. It's a WWE problem that they've had all year. And they've got to fix that, they've got to get away from that. Because there's a time and a place for it. Every single week is not the time and the place for it. So, we have a fatal, fatal four-way. A fatal four-way on this show. And in the middle of the match, out comes Paige. Paige is back. She asks the fans if they missed her and they start a yes chant. She said she's back and she did not come alone. And there's a joke in there, but I'm not going to make it. That's when Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville from NXT came out through the crowd and attacked the women in the ring. Paige gave Bayley the rampage. Backstage, Alexa Bliss walked up to the new trio to introduce herself and didn't really do her a lot of good because they put the boots to her as well and they left her laying. I like the idea of Paige leading a new group. I'm not sold on who they picked for the role. It may work out well. You know, WWE has made these types of decisions before. I mean, if you remember, I don't know if this was actually the plan or if this was just an idea that CM Punk had pitched, but the original third person that was sort of pegged for The Shield was not Roman Reigns. It was supposed to be, I think, Cassius Ohno, or at least that's what Punk wanted. Maybe it was just a matter of WWE saying to Punk, okay, thanks for the input, we'll take that under advisement. Maybe it was never official. But I try to visualize a Shield faction with Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Cassius Ohno, and I'm not going to say that it wouldn't have worked, or they wouldn't have been a good trio together, but I think things worked out a lot better the way they did. I think Roman Reigns is sort of the heavy of that group, was actually a much better fit for the Shield than Cassius Ohno ever would have been. So sometimes WWE will make a judgment call, whatever their rationale for it is. Oh, he's more muscled, or whatever. Whatever it is, they will sometimes make those decisions that may, you know, upset people. Or you may look at it and be like, oh man, you know, it's the wrong guy for the role. No, actually, I think that worked out pretty well. So sometimes what I'm trying to say is they actually know what they're doing. And so I think things will probably work out fine with these women. But again, not the two that I would have thought to put in this role. I think that Peyton Royce and Billy Kay, a lot of people were talking about them and were upset that they were not among the call-ups this week. I agree in that they have done all they can do. They haven't won the championship, that's true. Neither one have won the NXT Women's title, but I'm not sure they will. And they've been down there for so long, and they're perfectly capable wrestlers. And I like the act. I like the two of them being together. I wouldn't call them up and split them up. I wouldn't put one on Raw and one on SmackDown. But I feel like they've really, you know, been down there for so long, they've done all that they can do, just about. And if any two women are ready for the call-up, they would be on that list. I'd like to see them, I think SmackDown, honestly, may be a better fit for them, but I'd like to see them get the call-up. But there's also another angle to this, which is, do you want Peyton Royce and Billy Kay to be called up and be part of a group beyond just the two of them? Do you want them, for example, if Paige was to have brought them up, do you want them to come up and be subservient to Paige, where Paige is sort of like the leader and they're the followers? Because I don't see Peyton Royce and Billy Kay as being followers in a faction. So it may be a case where, again, this just wasn't the right role for them. They should be called up, but they should be called up on their own as a unit, just the two of them. But you look at Mandy Rose and you look at Sonya Deville, and Mandy Rose really does look like a young Trish Stratus. She got that young Trish Stratus vibe going for her. She's apparently really good for somebody with her experience level. She looks, I mean, for God's sake, she looks like $1 million. Sonya Deville, not as polished, really not polished at all. But I've liked what I've seen of her from NXT. You know, she's not offensive or anything like that. I think she plays that role fine. And, you know, that's what I thought NXT was for, though. When you have somebody who isn't polished, who still sort of needs to gain that experience and get to a certain level before they get called up to the quote-unquote big time, I thought, maybe foolishly, that that's what NXT was for. But I guess less and less so as time goes on. Now, on SmackDown, they did a carbon copy of this angle with Ruby Riott, Liv Morgan, and Sarah Logan, the former Crazy Mary Dobson, making their debut and laying out the ladies on that show, including the SmackDown Women's Champion, Charlotte. They laid waste to her as well. And when I say carbon copy, I don't just mean the fact that they debuted a new trio and had them lay everybody out, just like Paige and her crew did on Raw Monday night. I mean a carbon copy right down to the women they used. If you look at Paige and Ruby Riott, side by side, you'll definitely see a lot of similarities between the two. If you look at Mandy Rose and Liv Morgan, you will definitely see a lot of similarities between the two. Not so much Sonya Deville and Sarah Logan, although I guess you could kind of look at them maybe as the heavies of the group. And when I say heavies, I don't mean, you know, physically heavy. I just mean sort of the two ass kickers of the group. But there's less similarities between those two. But that was honestly the one thing I did not like about what they did with these women this week. It's that they just, again, I don't know if it's lazy writing or what it is, but they just, it's like they looked at this and said, well, why don't we just do the exact same thing on SmackDown that we did on Raw? So even in a situation like this, it's like people kind of joke about 50-50, right? Even Steven and 50-50 booking and all that. And even something like this, it's like they just can't help themselves. We did it on here. We have to do the same exact thing over here. Now, the one thing that would be pretty cool about this is if it were to come out that somehow Paige was sort of the link between both groups. I've seen, you know, some of you even tweeted me and said, what do you think about this idea? And I like that idea a lot. I like the idea that Paige may be somehow trying to lead some sort of invasion over all of the women's divisions in WWE. She and Emma, you could argue that match they had at the first NXT Arrival show back in 2014, they were sort of the catalysts of that whole women's revolution thing. And so it's kind of appropriate that Paige would be the one maybe to come back and start some sort of new revolution or some sort of new invasion of some kind. That would actually make sense. And that's something I think I'd like to see, but I don't see them so soon after Survivor Series wanting to do a mixing of the brands. Now, all of these new women debuting have led to speculation about there being a women's Royal Rumble match for the first time this year. My issue, the first time I ever raised this idea here on my show, which was last year. That was the first time I started talking about a women's Royal Rumble match. And at the time, I wasn't interested in it. My issue was that I felt it would be overkill to do more than one Rumble on the same show. Not to say that the women don't deserve to have their own Rumble match. They've had Hell in a Cell. They've had Money in the Bank. They absolutely should have a Royal Rumble match. I just thought, you know, it might water down the whole Rumble match concept. I don't know. I wasn't really a fan of it. And then when I was asked about it a few months later, I thought about it a little bit more. And I suggested that, you know what, maybe the way to go was to open the show with a women's Rumble. So that way you bookend the pay-per-view with two Rumble matches. You open with one and you end with one. And the women's one would obviously be smaller. It would not be a 30. I don't even think they have 30 women, honestly, on the two rosters combined. Not counting NXT, just looking at Raw and SmackDown. I don't even think they have 30. And I wouldn't have 30 women in it anyway. But I think you open the show with the match. You do half of 30. So 15 women coming out at 1 minute intervals. So the match moves a little bit quicker. 7 women from Raw. 7 women from SmackDown. You keep one spot open for a woman from NXT. Maybe even have them qualify for the spot leading up to the Rumble. You know, if there's an NXT TakeOver show the night before, which I believe there is, I think that might be the show in Philly, that could be where the person wins the right to enter the Women's Rumble the very next day. And the winner of the Rumble then challenges for their respective brand's title at WrestleMania. And if the person from NXT wins, they get to choose which title to compete for, and they earn a contract with that brand. I like that idea. And here's how I would break things down, based on the current roster. And the Rumble is still a ways away. We're still probably a good 2 months away from the Rumble. A lot can happen in 2 months. People could get hurt. More women could be called up. But here's how I would break things down. I would have Alexa Bliss defending her Raw Women's Championship at the Rumble against Paige. I think you build to Paige getting a championship match. And they already started doing that by booting Alexa in the gut and laying her out on Monday. So I would have the two of them face off for the championship at the Rumble. I would have Paige win the title. You also have Charlotte on the Rumble pay-per-view defending her title against Ruby Riott. So that could be another championship match. In the Rumble match, my 7 women from Raw would be Bayley, Sasha Banks, Nia Jax, Asuka, Alicia Fox, and Mickie James. My 7 from SmackDown would be Becky Lynch, Natalya, Naomi, Tamina, Carmella, Liv Morgan, and Sarah Logan. And I would have Asuka win the Rumble and challenge Paige for the Raw Women's title at WrestleMania. If the plan is to do horsewomen against horsewomen at Mania, then Sasha, Bayley, and Becky are all out as possible winners of a Royal Rumble match. So that's how I would lay it out. I like that idea. I like having that number of people from each brand. I like the idea they kept Asuka strong at Survivor Series. I forgot to mention that earlier. Got to give them credit for that. She was the sole survivor, which was my prediction and what I was hoping would happen, and they did it. And she was the last person standing, and they kept her strong, and I say you keep going. You keep that train moving along, and you have her win that Rumble match, and go on to challenge for the championship at WrestleMania. And then, back to Raw here, easily the most controversial part of the show. In case you couldn't tell, based on all the feedback this week, was Roman Reigns beating The Miz to become, for the first time, the new Intercontinental Champion. Reigns was booed way less than usual, which is a sign that this whole Shield reunion is doing exactly what they envisioned for it to accomplish. It will not stop him from being booed out of the building in New Orleans, but for the time being, his reactions are generally more positive than they are negative. It's not as bad as it was just a few months ago. That's an indisputable fact. They also had a pretty damn good match together, I thought, him and Miz. I wasn't expecting much from this match, but I enjoyed it. Miz jumped off the top rope right into a Superman punch for a great near fall. Reigns was setting up for a spear when Sheamus and Cesaro ran down for the distraction. That brought out Rollins and Ambrose, who fought them off. Miz hit the skull-crushing finale. Reigns kicked out, so obviously he's prepping for that F5 at WrestleMania. Reigns finally hit the spear on Miz to win the championship, thus joining the ranks of the Grand Slam Club, having now held the Intercontinental, the US, the Tag Team, and the WWE titles. He'll be adding the Universal title to that list soon enough. Of course, that's less impressive when you consider that Roman isn't even the first Shield member to be a Grand Slam champion. That would be Dean Ambrose, who has held the IC, US, Tag Team, and WWE title. So I guess maybe that gives Seth Rollins a brand new rationale for turning on his buddies again. He feels left out. Now, the reason for the title change is that Miz is off to film a new Marine movie. I think actually this Monday, I think tomorrow, up in Canada, they begin filming. This is the sixth installment in the Marine franchise. Hard to believe that thing is still going. Becky Lynch and Shawn Michaels also have roles in the film. This is the premise from the press release. When Jake Carter, The Miz, and fellow Marine Luke Trapper, Shawn Michaels, stumble upon a kidnapped girl being held prisoner by a dangerous gang of international criminals, they find themselves in the crosshairs as they try to save the girl and bring her kidnappers to justice. So Shawn Michaels, of all people, is now a Marine. Well, I guess if you can't beat him, you join him. Now he gets to play one on the big screen. Let's be honest, ain't nobody watching this on the big screen, unless that big screen is mounted on the wall in their living room. But, I don't know, you know, those three in an action movie actually sounds mildly interesting, so I think I may have to check that one out. By the way, I have seen Miz in these Marine movies. He's not bad. I wouldn't call them good movies, but whatever, they're fun for what they are. They're really not that terrible. Believe me, I've seen far worse. Even from WWE films, I've seen far worse. You could do a lot worse than these Marine movies. So after the show backstage, Roman gave an interview. He said that he is bringing back the open challenge concept, the open challenge gimmick that he stole from John Cena and used when he was the United States champion. Contrary to popular belief, and this really was the source, I think, of a lot of debate and a lot of the hatred this week, I don't think that Roman Reigns is holding this title until WrestleMania. I really don't think, you know, a lot of people thinking, oh, they're just going to recreate Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior from WrestleMania 6, and WrestleMania is going to end with Roman holding two belts, you know, and I don't think that they're doing that. I think he drops the title before then, even if it's one of those sort of cliched, like a few weeks before WrestleMania, there's a distraction and Roman is pinned, but it's only because he was distracted and they just do it as a way to get the belt off of him. I could see that. I don't see him holding that championship through WrestleMania. I would have liked to see Finn Balor get the title. You know, if he's not getting the match with Brock Lesnar, then, you know, the Intercontinental title could have been a good, you know, like a consolation prize for the guy, I guess. You know, I think somebody like that could have benefited more from having that title than Roman Reigns. Roman having this title doesn't do fuck all for him. It doesn't do him shit. You know what I mean? Like, it really is just, we have nothing better for him to do until he gets to Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania. So let's just put a championship on him. Or maybe they're going to put the tag team belts back on Rollins and Ambrose, and so they want Roman to have a belt, and so all of them can be champions. Whatever their rationale is, no. It's not going to do him any favors. Is it going to elevate the title? No. How many times have we talked about this before? Like, you know, every time some big name gets the belt, oh, they're going to elevate it. This is going to elevate the U.S. title. This is going to elevate the Intercontinental Championship. I will say this. The only time that I think you can make that argument was when John Cena started doing the open challenge concept with the U.S. title. I think it made the U.S. title way more interesting. I think it made it a lot more fun. And because of how big of a star he was and because of how frequently he was defending it, yes, you can make the argument that John Cena actually did help, at least for a few months, did help elevate that U.S. title. I'll give you that. But I also remember when Roman Reigns was the U.S. champion, and he defended the title here and there, but not nearly as much as John Cena did. And he just, it was just sort of a prop for Roman to literally hang over his back. I will never forget Mick Foley being in the middle of the ring with him on Raw and having to actually physically adjust the belt on Roman's shoulder, because in his mind, that's disrespecting the title. You don't do that. Yeah, that was kind of embarrassing, to be honest with you. I don't think that he intended to embarrass Roman by doing that, but I'll never forget that moment. So I was not impressed at all by his U.S. title run. I don't really have a real reason to be any more enamored with him being the Intercontinental Champion now. So this idea that he'll somehow elevate the title, I don't buy it. I really don't. But if he's going to do the open challenge concept, and if it's going to be anything like the way John Cena did it, then you know what? I'll keep an open mind. But I would not have put that belt on him. I'm not sure why they didn't just have Balor beat Miz for the title and then immediately have Samoa Joe come out and choke him out. So instead of doing the Balor-Joe match, you just do Balor and Miz and then have Joe come out and choke him out. And that sets up Balor defending against Joe in an actual program for the IC title. I think that in and of itself, having two stars like Balor and Joe fighting over it, that would have done a lot more to quote-unquote elevate that title than Roman holding it. I just don't see what purpose this serves. So, but I'm not angry about it. I mean, I see some people are really upset, like in the Facebook group and everything. Like there's people who are genuinely distraught about this man being the Intercontinental Champion. I get angry about obvious things, that this company misses the mark on things that should be so obvious and they just don't do it. Like that gets me upset, or really stupid shit that they do. This, I'm kind of just indifferent to it. I just sort of don't care, you know? But the open challenge concept, it could open up some fun matches. And again, I really don't think they're keeping that title on him all the way to WrestleMania. I have nothing to base that on. That's just my gut feeling. But if you are worried about that, you know, I would calm your nerves down, because I really don't think that he'll be holding it, you know, for that long. They aired a vignette on 205 Live this week hyping the debut of Hideo Itami, coming soon, it said. It's been rumored for a few weeks now, and I said in my Survivor Series predictions that Enzo would move on from Kalisto to feud with either Hideo Itami or Neville, if Neville does come back. Now, I don't know that Itami is going to be feuding with Enzo right away, but it's the best role for him right now, because outside of the cruiserweight stuff, I see him just being booked to do nothing on that main roster. I see him drowning on that main roster. If he looks strong in the cruiserweight division for a while, and it's going to come down to two things. A, can he stay healthy? Can he stay injury-free? And B, the booking. Do they protect him? Do they portray him as a badass and start knocking people out with the go-to-sleep? Or does he end up being more of a comedy character? Does he end up being tag team partners with Tozawa? Because, you know, haha, let's put the two Japanese guys together. You know, it's all in how they portray this guy. And I think it's sink or swim, because if this doesn't work, then I don't see there being a real role for him. So those are my thoughts from Raw. SmackDown Live, it was the last of four nights in Houston. They ran the building four straight nights. 1,700 votes in the Twitter poll, 61% thumbs up, 39% thumbs down. I already talked about Ruby Riott and Sarah Logan and Liv Morgan making their debut, coming out and attacking the women of SmackDown and laying out Natalya and laying out Charlotte and laying out Becky Lynch backstage. The reason that they did that, injury angle, they basically slammed a door on her midsection. That was to write her out for a while because she's off to film that movie with The Miz. So they really laid waste to the women, and Naomi as well. They laid waste to the women of SmackDown here. Not really, you know, I can't really say that I'm a huge fan of the introduction of them sort of walking up to Naomi at the makeup table backstage and just starting to beat her up. I didn't think that was overly creative, but it's three new women on the show, which, you know, hey, fresh faces on the show. There's nothing really terrible about that. We had Charlotte defending the women's title against Natalya, who was owed her rematch after losing the championship the week before. And we had Riott, Morgan, and Logan coming out through the crowd attacking Natalya. And so I guess the match was either a DQ or maybe a no contest. I don't know. But they jumped in the ring. They laid waste to Charlotte. They each hit their move. And so the new women stood tall. And I think the women's divisions needed a little bit of a shakeup. They got them. That's what I like. It's just like what I said earlier, though. The thing I'm not a fan of is how they had to debut them in identical fashion in the very same week they did the same thing on Raw. And so that I wasn't so much a fan of. The Bludgeon Brothers. The Bludgeon Brothers have been hyped up for weeks now in these vignettes. Harper and Rowan, they were going to make their big comeback. Well, they made their debut here on this show, their re-debut. I thought their entrance was cool. I dig their new music. I think that they're out there looking like they're playing Kane for Halloween with those new outfits. But it was just, you know, they had a match with the Hype Bros, and it was a short Smash Mouth match, the way it should be. You know, and they've lost interest in these guys so many times before, and Harper especially. I think it's criminal. It is criminal how underutilized this guy is, and how he just sort of exists on the main roster without actually doing anything, without actually being anything, that it's a shame. And I'm hopeful that maybe this will be the role that actually heats him up, makes him interesting again, gets him doing stuff on the show. So I hope they let these two go on a tear for a while, and I think they could be a solid addition to the tag team division. We had AJ Styles come out for a promo, and I thought that AJ was great here in the segment. I thought he got a great reaction. It's a fantastic example of, even though the guy goes in there and he's the champ and he gets beat by another guy, he went in there and he took it to Brock Lesnar. He had a great showing. He came close a couple of times. It was a great match. And he comes out of it stronger for it, even in defeat. This is a great example of that. He came out here, got this great response. They put Paul Heyman's video up that Paul recorded backstage after the show outside of Brock's locker room. He was putting over AJ. He couldn't put AJ over anymore. If he put him over anymore, he would have fallen over the top of the fence. He was putting this guy over like $1 million. They aired that video up on the big screen. And people clapped and cheered for it. So I thought everything was great while AJ was out there talking about the match with Brock at Survivor Series. He was like, you know, I may have lost, but I wasn't the one who limped to the back. And people, they like that line. And AJ teased a rematch. He said, look, if there was going to be an AJ and a Brock Lesnar part two, I'm down for it. Just remember that in Rocky 2, Rocky wins. And people cheered like they wanted to see that rematch. I would love to see that rematch. And then AJ turned his attention to Jinder Mahal. And I swear to you, it's like somebody took a Hoover vacuum and sucked the life out of that building. You could practically feel the groans going from Brock Lesnar to Jinder Mahal. Styles took off his vest. He laid the title down on the mat. He called Jinder out. I'll give you a match right now, here in this ring, right then and there. I'll give you a championship match. And of course, Jinder pops up on the big screen instead. And he's like, you took advantage of me in the middle of a European tour. And then he kind of stumbled over his words a little bit. And he said that if it were me wrestling Brock Lesnar at Survivor Series, I would have been standing there as the Beastmaster. And, you know, I said this on Wade Keller's show when I did the show with him on Tuesday, and then the show went up on Wednesday, but I said when I heard that line, all I could think of, the first thing I thought of was the original Ghostbusters movie. And I thought of, like, are you the gatekeeper? No, I'm the keymaster. Like, I'm thinking about that, I'm like, Beastmaster? Like, who writes this shit? Who writes this shit? Beastmaster. Sounds like a grill that you buy at like fucking Lowe's or something. Buy the Beastmaster 5000. You can get it for cheap. Black Friday sale. So that was, and AJ called him out for it. He said that was a stupid thing to say, which it was. Jinder said that he brought prestige to the championship. And I had to pause because I wanted to finish laughing before I resume my watching of this show. He says, I'm not going to fight in a place like Texas. I want my rematch at Clash of Champions. or as Booker T has called it multiple times. I believe during the pre-show for Survivor Series, when they were hyping the next pay-per-view, he multiple times called it Clash of the Champions. It's a hard habit to break. I really don't know why they didn't just call the show Clash of the Champions. It's like they have to put their fucking mark on everything. You know what I mean? Like, well, WCW called it this. Let's take out the word the, and we'll make it our own. And Booker's not the only one. I've heard other people make that mistake, too, by calling it Clash of the Champions. It's a minor thing. But that's why, right? It's a minor thing. Why even change it? Just use the name. Why do you have to change it? Anyway, he wants his match at Clash of Champions. And he laughed. He did the evil, like, supervillain laugh. And the Singh brothers came out. They attacked AJ from behind. AJ fought them off. He gave one of them a Styles Clash. I believe he's wrestling them in a handicap match on TV this Tuesday. I thought AJ was great throughout this entire segment. I thought Jinder was bland as usual. And just what a come down. You talk about a come down that this was compared to the Lesnar-Styles match and the build-up to it and the match itself at Survivor Series. I'm not looking forward to this match at Clash of Champions. And for the people who were worried that they're just going to put the belt back on Jinder, they're not putting the belt back on Jinder. I cannot see them putting that belt back on Jinder at Clash of Champions. I don't see it. They have to realize that the belt is in better hands with AJ Styles, that the people want to see AJ as the champion, that the matches, the match quality will be far better with AJ in that role, that people are not clamoring to see John Cena beat Jinder Mahal for the championship. And if they were, even if people wanted to see John Cena come back as the conquering American hero and take the title from Jinder Mahal, it would have been to end his reign of terror. Well, the reign of terror ended already. AJ put an end to it. So just to put the belt back on him again, just so you can get it off and put it on Cena, is stupid. I don't know anybody who is clamoring for that. So no, I don't see them putting the belt back on Jinder. And the India tour, which isn't even a tour, it's one date. They couldn't even sell tickets to two. They cut it down to one. But it doesn't matter because that comes before the pay-per-view. So there really is no incentive to put the championship back on this guy at the next show. It's not happening. AJ is retaining. Now, the show opened, and this was a show-long storyline. The show opened with Shane McMahon nearly firing Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn for almost costing Team SmackDown the match at Survivor Series. I say almost because they, even though they came out and they attacked Shane and they interfered, Shane fought them off single-handedly with a steel chair. That's how effective Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn were at the pay-per-view. They interfered and they got chased away by Shane McMahon. What a waste that was. But because they did that, Shane was very upset with them and he was ready to fire them. And then Daniel Bryan came out and he rescued them and said, you know what, why don't we do a lumberjack match? Because the New Day is still very upset at you guys for deserting them when the Shield came out the week before. And so we'll do Owens and Zayn against the New Day and we'll have the rest of the SmackDown roster surrounding the ring and we'll make it a lumberjack match. And Shane was okay with that. In fact, later on in the show, Shane even said, look, I like your idea. I like what you're doing, Daniel. You're putting these guys in a lumberjack match, and when the match is over, you're going to fire them. And I can't wait to see it. In fact, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go back to the hotel and watch it on TV. And Shane left. So, and when you fast forward to what they did at the end of the show, where Brian, in fact, admitted that he had no intention, he was never planning on firing these guys, it's going to be very interesting to see where this goes. They are continuing to build tension between Brian and Shane, which, again, I know the likelihood is slim, very slim, but it almost feels like they are building to a match between Shane and Brian at WrestleMania. There's no other conclusion that you would be led to when you see segments where, you know, they're planting these little seeds of dissension between the two of them, and how do you resolve that? You know, what's the climax? What's the big payoff? Usually it's a match. So I don't know where they're going with this. But they are continuing to build. Now, fast forward to the end of the show. It is a lumberjack match. Owens and Zayn against the New Day. It was funny watching Sammy try to run away. And the lumberjacks pick him up in the aisleway and literally carry him back into the ring and throw him back in. So, fast forward to the end, the brawl broke out, all the lumberjacks are going at it now because Baron Corbin screwed the whole thing up, he nailed Bobby Roode by accident, and all hell broke loose. So the lumberjacks are fighting all the way to the back, And Xavier Woods is in the ring. He knocks Mike Kanellis out of the ring. Remember him? He actually still works for WWE. Owens then knocks Woods out of the ring. Kofi nails Kevin Owens. And then off the distraction, Sami Zayn rolls up Kofi and pins him. The old distraction roll-up gives Owens and Zayn the win. Now, after the match, New Day went to go after Kevin Owens, but he ran away through the crowd. He left his buddy behind. He left his best friend all by his lonesome to get slaughtered by the New Day in the ring. They laid him out with the midnight hour. Backstage, Kevin Owens confronts Daniel Bryan, and he begs Daniel Bryan not to fire him. He even gets down on his knees, begging this man not to fire him. And Bryan laughs. He's like, I was never going to fire you guys. In fact, I've already signed you for a match on SmackDown next week with your Twitter buddy, Randy Orton. So that's the main event for SmackDown this week. It's Kevin Owens against Randy Orton. Maybe they'll have a tweet off. I don't know. But actually, you know what would be kind of funny is, you know, for all the back and forth between those two on Twitter recently, and there have been some pretty sick burns, I will say, between the two of them. If they build to that match in the main event, like, they don't come out to cut promos, they don't touch, they don't brawl, they don't confront each other before the main event. Throughout the show, backstage, they're just tweeting each other. And they put the tweets up on the screen, and it's just nothing but nonstop insults back and forth between the two of them. They literally just tweet their way, they tweet their promos throughout the entire show, and it builds to the main event. I guarantee you that would be more entertaining than any in-ring promo with Randy Orton. He would be far better off just tweeting his opponents from the back and then showing the messages up on the big screen. So anyway, I was not a huge fan of Owens getting on his knees to beg, but he is a heel. I don't know that it completely fits his character to take it that far. That was a little weird, and maybe that has to do with him having residual heat for some stuff that happened recently when they sent him home from the European tour. It is possible they just did that to embarrass him, but... You know, we'll follow the Shane and Bryan thing, because this is obviously leading to something, and if not a match, I don't know what, unless the idea is that ultimately it results in Daniel Bryan being relieved of his GM duties, and they fire him, just to get him off TV. But I don't know why you wouldn't want to have him on TV. If he can't wrestle, then what else are you going to use him for? You know, and I don't know the nature of his contract, so... Maybe I'm speaking out of turn on this, but I just remember when Rey Mysterio was with the company, and Rey was always hurt. So there was so much time that Rey missed for injuries that when his contract was to have come due, I guess there was some kind of clause, it rolled over, it extended the contract, and he fought them on this, and they were like, well, you haven't been working. And so therefore, it was almost like his deal was frozen, and so he wasn't able to leave when he thought he would be able to leave. I don't know if WWE would try something like that with Bryan, where they take him off TV, and then when his contract comes due later in the year, they try to make the argument that, well, we haven't been using you, and you haven't been on TV, and so effectively your deal is sort of frozen. I don't know the legalities of it, if they could even do that. Because Bryan, he's not even hiding it anymore. I mean, he does interviews now and says that if they're not going to let me wrestle, there's like an 85% chance that you're going to see me wrestling somewhere else. And I know that, I'm sure WWE doesn't want to lose the guy. I don't know that they would blatantly try to screw him like that, because it really isn't his fault. They're the ones telling him you can't work. It would be immensely shitty of them to do something like that. But I don't put it past them. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that they've done something like that. So, if they do take him off TV, I wonder how that would work. I wonder if they would actually try to use that against him and try to keep him from going to wrestle for a New Japan or a Ring of Honor or some other promotion. Before we get to NXT, nominations are now open in the 2018 Wrestling Radio Awards. Just go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com and you can scroll down to the category for Show of the Year and type in Solomonster Sounds Off and submit your vote. We've won Show of the Year each of the last 3 years. Would love to make it 4 in a row. Last year, we also won for Interview of the Year for one of the 2 interviews I did with Diamond Dallas Page. This year, you can vote for my interview with former WWE ring announcer Justin Roberts for Male Interview of the Year. Just scroll down to that category and type in Justin Roberts on Solomonster Sounds Off and submit your vote. It was a really in-depth conversation about not only his experiences working for so many years in WWE, but just the inner workings of a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff there. It's over an hour long. You can also vote for my interview with former WWE writer Dave Lagana from back in March. That was also a great chat, talking about the writing process and working for WWE, working with Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman. That interview was almost 90 minutes long. Both of those are up on my YouTube channel right now if you have not heard them, so definitely check those out. There was a lot of great insight from both of those interviews. So either one of those, I think, are worthy of your consideration for Male Interview of the Year. Choose whichever one you like, if you would be so inclined to do so. Remember, you can vote once a day, every day, until nominations close. This is for nominations only. Show some love for the Sound Off. This has been our biggest year yet. Every year is bigger than the one before it. And I can't thank you guys enough for all the support. I'm already looking forward to seeing a lot of you in New Orleans next year, so I'm already looking ahead to that. But again, WrestlingRadioAwards.com. Bookmark that. Vote every day, and hopefully we'll be able to pull off four in a row this year. NXT. Got some NXT notes here. Final poll result, in fact, I have for TakeOver War Games. I put the Twitter poll up. It got a lot of positive feedback. I was waiting for the poll to end, and the results are in. And this was probably the most feedback I've ever gotten to an NXT poll, over 3,400 votes for this show. I asked you, what was the best match at TakeOver? I didn't ask you thumbs up, thumbs down, because this was an easy thumbs up show. There's no way this show is getting anything less than 90% thumbs up, and if we're being honest here, this show shouldn't have gotten any less than 100% thumbs up. But I asked you, what was the best match at TakeOver? I wanted to make this a little more challenging. And 46% of you said War Games. 42% of you said Aleister Black against the Velveteen Dream. 9% said Drew McIntyre against Andrade Cien Almas. And bringing it up the rear with 3% was the Fatal 4-Way. That's another example of a Fatal 4-Way involving women. Unbelievable. Fatal 4-Way for the NXT Women's title. That had 3%. So, War Games edged out the match between Aleister Black and Velveteen Dream, but not by much. 46-42. It's pretty close. So, and I got a lot, again, a lot of you people told me that this was the most challenging poll you've ever had to answer. Like, you actually had to stop what you were doing and think for a minute about what you were going to vote for. It wasn't such an easy, hey, thumbs up, thumbs down. So, thank you to everybody who voted. Now, there's no new update on Drew McIntyre's arm injury. Apparently, he was due for a main roster call-up soon before his TakeOver match with Andrade Cien Almas. That would obviously be on hold for a while if he needs surgery. We just don't know yet. The belief is still that he tore his biceps in his arm. WWE has not announced anything yet. They have not announced the results of the MRI, which I assume was already completed. We're just sort of in limbo right now as far as how severe the injury is. Hopefully it's not as bad as they initially feared, and maybe he can be back in a matter of weeks, but we just don't know yet. Now, I watched the NXT show this week. They had a Ruby Riott match against Sonya Deville, which is kind of funny given that both of them are now on the main roster, one on Raw, one on SmackDown, and the match was okay. It wasn't anything great. I was looking forward to the UK title match. It was Pete Dunne defending his United Kingdom Championship for the first time against a non-UK star, against Johnny Gargano. This was taped from the Toyota Center in Houston. The two rings were there for War Games. Obviously, they kept the action to one. And they had a great match. Surprise, surprise. I know. How shocking that Pete Dunne and Johnny Gargano would have gone in there and had a great match. They fought outside the ring early on. Dunne gave him the X-Plex on the apron. The X-Plex, basically, he just picks him up into the air for a vertical suplex, but just flips him and lets him fall. And, of course, the ring apron is the hardest part of the ring. They love telling us that. So that happened early on in the match. And Pete Dunne doing the joint manipulation stuff, bending the fingers very slowly, very painful. Johnny made a comeback. He locked in the Gargano escape, but Pete Dunne... And this is unique. I've not seen him do this before. He spat out the mouthpiece that he had in, and he bit Johnny's fingers, the fingers that he had worked on earlier, and he was bending back and forth. He bit down on the injured fingers to get out of the move. So that was very unique. Dunne punched Gargano in the face. Gargano fell backwards into the ropes. He bounced off with what initially looked like a DDT, but it turned into a small package for a near fall. Dunn nailed a wicked forearm. Again, Gargano fell backwards into the ropes, and Dunn then hit an enziguri. Gargano fell into the ropes again, and when he bounced off, he obliterated Pete Dunn with a discus clothesline. Everybody at this point is on their feet. They're chanting loud chants of NXT. Gargano starts crawling towards Pete Dunn, and he stops, and he looks down, and he spots the mouthpiece. And for a moment there, I thought, this motherfucker is going to put this thing in his mouth. That's disgusting. But he didn't do that. And why did I think that? Because wrestlers do sick shit like that. How many times have we seen wrestlers lick people's blood and do all this nasty shit? Why do they do that? There's no reason. They do it because they can. So it's all mind games. It's all mind games in these matches. Thankfully, he didn't put the mouthpiece in his mouth. He tossed it aside. He gave Dunn a super kick. Got a great near fall out of it. Finish saw Pete Dunne counter a slingshot spear with a punch right to the face. And the win with the bitter end. 1-2-3. Great match, if not a bit short. I think they really needed like another 8 to 10 minutes on a takeover show. And that could have ended up being a match of the year candidate. But I enjoyed the hell out of what we got. I certainly wouldn't mind seeing it again. I'd like to see Pete Dunne defend that UK title more often. And I don't really see the issue in him defending against somebody from the U.S. I saw a couple of people online make issue or take issue with that. I don't really see what the big deal is. Just because it's the U.K. title, to me, doesn't mean it has to exclusively be defended against U.K. people. And plus, Johnny Gargano, look, he's got a third uncle on his mother's side who was born in Great Britain. He's got a little bit of English blood in him. I don't know if that's true. I just made that up. But don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. So Gargano backstage after the show on the YouTube channel, they put an interview up where one of the female bots is interviewing him in the back and said, oh, this was a great match. I mean, you fell short, but are you happy with your performance? And it was a great match. And Gargano was just like, yeah, great effort and great match. That's the story of my career. I'm Mr. Great Effort, Great Match. But in the end, I can never really pull it out. And he basically said that he was numb. He didn't feel anything. He wants to feel again. This was like emo Johnny Gargano. He's going to start cutting himself. Like, don't do that. But he says, I want to feel. I want to feel again. So look, if Drew is hurt, I go back to what I said after the McIntyre injury happened to TakeOver in my review last week. If Drew is hurt, and he's going to be out, and he's not getting a rematch, and they need somebody new to plug in there, a new babyface to plug in there, Johnny Gargano is as good as anybody I could think of. Even though he's on a losing streak. Even though we've already seen him against Almas a couple of different times. Now is the time where you start to build him back up. His luck begins to change. And I don't know if it's somebody else in the back who confronts him, William Regal, somebody smacks him in the face to wake him up. Whatever it is, he starts to win matches. His luck begins to turn. And in the end, he's able to become number one contender. We have some time before the next TakeOver show. The next TakeOver show is not until the end of January. They could build this guy up, and he could be a good interim opponent, I think, for Almas before Aleister Black, because I do think Aleister Black is going to get the title shot and probably get the title WrestleMania weekend in New Orleans. But I think Johnny Gargano is the perfect opponent for Almas, but they've got to start turning this guy around now. Otherwise, it makes no sense. If he loses every match, how are you going to give the guy a title shot? You've got to build him up to it. Before I get to the mailbag, I wanted to talk about this for a little bit. There is a new documentary that just hit Netflix this past week. It's about the late Andy Kaufman. Of course, Andy Kaufman was a big wrestling fan, worked this famous angle down in Memphis with Jerry Lawler. Wanted to work an angle and do something for Vince McMahon Sr. in WWF. In the early 80s, and Vince Sr. was not into the whole celebrity thing, and he turned down Andy Kaufman flat. He's like, yeah, we're not interested. And it was actually Bill Apter, who I've interviewed here on the show before. Bill is just a national treasure. And it was Bill Apter who was able to put Andy Kaufman together with Jerry Lawler, and that's what got the ball rolling on the angle in Memphis with Kaufman and Lawler. And so the documentary is not just about the wrestling portion. It's about the behind-the-scenes filming of the movie The Man on the Moon, or I guess Man on the Moon it was called, which was the movie that Jim Carrey starred in about the life of Andy Kaufman. The movie came out in 99. They filmed it in 98. This documentary is called Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond. and it's basically a movie about the making of a movie. Jim Carrey is the only person interviewed for it. So the only current modern day interview footage is Jim Carrey sitting in a chair looking at the camera. And this was filmed recently. It was filmed in the present day. Now what this is it is Jim Carrey's own personal footage. It was locked away for almost 20 years after Universal, the movie studio, refused to let him release it for fear that, and this is according to Carrey, what the studio told him, they did not want him releasing this footage because they were worried that people might think he's an asshole. Which, by the way, he probably is an asshole. You watch this movie and you come away from it thinking, this guy is a giant asshole. But the studio didn't want that because if people think he's an asshole, why would they pay money to see him? And so the footage was locked away. All these years, he had people filming him every single day on set during the filming of this movie. And why? Because he was in character the entire time. From the moment he started filming, he was Andy Kaufman from start to finish, from day one until the final day of shooting. And that included when the director yelled cut off camera, in the trailer, you know, in catering. He was Andy Kaufman, and it drove people absolutely nuts. How Milos Forman, the director of this movie, didn't strangle this guy, I'll never know. This guy is an accomplished movie director, and he had to put up with this shit for 4 months straight. And sometimes it was him playing Andy Kaufman. Andy Kaufman, if you remember back in the day, had this sort of alternate character called... oh my goodness, what was... the name just popped up. Tony Clifton. I almost forgot the name. So he had this other character that he often portrayed called Tony Clifton, who was a real, just complete douche nozzle, this guy. So there were days where they would shoot and it would be Tony Clifton. And obviously it was Jim Carrey playing Tony Clifton. He was in the makeup and everything. And he was even more of an asshole to the people on set. The people on set were genuinely terrified on the days where they knew that it was quote-unquote Tony Clifton coming in to shoot. Because they knew that it was just going to be a miserable day. And there is something, I guess, to being that into the art and just immersing yourself in the character and being that dedicated to the role that I can actually appreciate. But I also put myself in the position of all the other people on the set, the other actors, the directors, the stagehands, and the makeup people and everybody else. And I think if I had to work in that environment for 4 straight months with this guy, behaving the way that he was behaving, if you watch this movie, it would have been awful. I would have quit. I mean, he put these people through just hell for those 4 months. And, you know, I'm sure some people by the end were sad that it was over, but I'm sure there were a lot of people who were like, I can't wait to get away from this guy. And it also becomes a lot clearer why Jerry Lawler hates Jim Carrey. Because wrestling is a very big part of the film. They do cover that a lot. And there's footage that Carrey shot, or the people filming him, shot of Lawler. And you see the cat, remember his old girlfriend, Stacy Carter? She was on set with Lawler. And Jim Carrey terrorized this man. He made Lawler's life on this set a living hell. Lawler wanted to just decapitate this man. He literally at one point went after him and grabbed him and he was going to beat the fuck out of him. And people had to pull Lawler off of him. And there was the famous incident that actually made the news. There was a scene they were shooting and Lawler gave him a pile driver and they thought that he really injured him. And Carrey... he wasn't hurt, but he was selling it like, how far do I take this? I'm going to pretend that I'm actually hurt. And they loaded him on a gurney into the ambulance, and they took him to the hospital, and he was in a neck brace. And they had all the news media reports from 99, you know, or 98, I guess they filmed it. But showing that, like, you know, Jim Carrey attacked on set by professional wrestler Jerry Lawler, and or stunt gone wrong. Like they were portraying it as though this was a real injury, because that's how Carrey played it up. And I remember that, actually. I remember hearing about that and seeing those news reports back then. I got to tell you, watching this was more interesting than the Man on the Moon movie itself. And I thought Man on the Moon was a great movie, but this was way more interesting. This really was. This was a combination of both filming Jim Carrey in the role, but also it was a movie about Jim Carrey. They talked about his upbringing. They talked about his family and how he was, you know, always trying to please his parents and... yeah, they talked about Andy as well. I mean, it was a good sort of biographical look into his life with all of this other footage, never before seen footage, spliced in. And it was a fascinating watch. But on the Lawler stuff, you know, what Lawler took issue with is the fact that, and Lawler was interviewed at the time, so there is footage of Lawler, interview footage of Lawler. It's just not current footage. But Lawler in the film says, "Look, you know, I don't like this because I knew Andy Kaufman, and Andy Kaufman never behaved like that off camera. The way that Jim Carrey is behaving, spitting on me, and hurling insults at me and throwing things at me and running away. Like, Andy didn't do that. Off camera, when the camera was off, Andy was great. Look, Andy, I hear about Andy Kaufman. Andy Kaufman sounds like the classic wrestling mark. He was a huge wrestling fan. Just like us. I'm sure the last thing Andy Kaufman would have done, you know, when the cameras were off, was spit on Jerry Lawler. Or do something to disrespect Jerry Lawler. So that was Lawler's issue. He's like, I don't know, this guy's doing all these things. He's an asshole. Andy never did this. We were always very cordial with one another. And Carrie was just being a dick all the time, 24/7. So it's a fascinating film. I don't want to give, you know, too much away. There's a lot of other kind of funny things in there. But I come away from this thinking, man, this is a really good film. Jim Carrey is a very oddball character. There's a lot going on in that guy's head. He's not all there. You could probably say that about a lot of actors in Hollywood. But I can at least appreciate the fact that this guy, he became Andy Kaufman. I mean, for those 4 months, he became Andy Kaufman. It was so weird. Family members of Andy, his parents, his sister, his daughter, I think his sister, his daughter. And they didn't have footage of this, but apparently he tells the story during the movie of Andy's daughter. Came to the set one day to like visit him, and it was just the two of them in the trailer together for like over an hour. But it was almost like they were living vicariously through Jim Carrey. It was almost as though they felt that the soul of Andy had possessed Jim Carrey. And so they were living through Carrey as a way to communicate with Andy. It was so weird. And I mean, families cope in their own ways. I'm not like making fun of it. It was just bizarre. And to hear him talk about that, and you see him sort of hugging and embracing Andy's like real life father, it's fascinating stuff. There's a Playboy Mansion story, by the way, in the film. And there's footage as well from the Playboy party. I won't spoil it, but you really should go out of your way to see this movie. It's really, really well done. It's about an hour and a half. Frustrating at times, but really, really fascinating stuff. I mean, I highly recommend that you go and check it out. I give it 2 thumbs up. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have them, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We'll start with Jay in the UK. You said you liked that Jinder Mahal was not involved in the match between Brock Lesnar and AJ Styles at Survivor Series. But what if after the match, Jinder attacked AJ? Lesnar would be on the ramp as this is happening and decide to return to the ring and help AJ fend off Jinder and the Singh brothers, because A, he has a newfound respect for AJ after the match, and B, he's been wanting to get his hands on Jinder for all the crap that he's been talking during the build-up to their original match. This could end with Brock raising AJ's hand and endorsing him as a legitimate champion. What do you think? I think Lesnar endorsing AJ Styles like that would be so contrary and opposite to everything that Brock Lesnar stands for, that I would find it completely unbelievable. Him wanting to beat up Jinder, I could see. Even better, Jinder could sort of scamper away, and Brock could just fling the Singh brothers around. But him raising AJ's hand or somehow endorsing him, while cool, I mean, I think that'd be cool, it would never, ever happen. He might give him like a nod or something. You know, but that's about it. I mean, there's just, I can't see that. It just would not fit in Brock's character. Let's see here. I was wondering if you had the chance to listen to the Austin Aries interview on Talk is Jericho. He talked about his departure from WWE. And to be honest, I'm a little confused as to what actually happened. He claims he was released and that he had nothing bad to say about the company. But I've listened to him on MVP's podcast and he speaks about WWE in a negative way. What are your thoughts? Well, I haven't heard the MVP interview. I heard about the Jericho interview. I didn't actually listen to it. I mean, my question would be, are he and Zelina Vega still an item? I know they were engaged, but then I saw people saying that that's no longer the case. So I don't know what to believe as far as whether or not he and Zelina Vega are still together. But I bring this up because if they are together, I could see him not wanting to burn any bridges and say anything that could possibly cause problems for his fiance. There's a reason that AJ Lee didn't stick around for very long after the shit hit the fan with WWE and CM Punk. You know, as much as you would like to think that one doesn't affect the other, it does. So if he does have issues with the company and would love to just sort of lace into them, it would be smart for him to keep his mouth shut so long as the two of them are together. If they're not together anymore, then I don't know. I don't know how to reconcile him saying that, well, they released me and I have no bad blood, but yet you're saying in this other interview he has negative things to say. If there's no Zelina Vega relationship anymore, then maybe he just doesn't want to burn a bridge. Maybe one day he wants to leave the door open to come back. I don't know. Here's an audio question sent in all the way from Saudi Arabia from Abdulaziz.
Hey, Salamonster, it's Abdulaziz from Saudi Arabia. With the possible death of Dario Cueto in Lucha Underground, who do you think is a good replacement? My opinion from watching him in ROH, I think Truth Martini is a suitable replacement. He's great on the mic, and on top of all that, he can bring his hoopla with him. What do you think? Thanks.
I don't think there really is, honestly, a good replacement for Dario Cueto. I think he'll be back. I hope he'll be back. The show just won't be the same without him. I like Truth Martini. I was kind of surprised to hear that he was, I think, let go a while back from Ring of Honor. I just don't see him in that role, honestly. I mean, if I had to... And remember, Dario's not a wrestling guy. He's an actor that they brought in to portray that role, and he nailed it. So when I think of a wrestling personality to plug in there, who would do as good of a job, maybe, as he did, they're few and far between. It's hard to think of one, but the one name that I was thinking of was the Sinister Minister. I don't know what he's up to these days, you know, James Vandenberg, but he was somebody who I thought played that character very well and would have gone well with a character like Kane in WWE if they ever wanted to put Kane back together with a manager, you know, that wasn't Paul Bearer. I'm kind of surprised he never ended up there, to be honest with you. I think that he would have been a good kind of evil heel manager. But I think that character would work very well on a show like Lucha Underground with all of the sci-fi elements and gods and demons and that sort of thing. You know, dialogue-wise, could he deliver in a role like that? I don't know. Until you actually... Like, they'd have to bring him in probably for a casting call like they would for any other TV show and see how he does. But I just think that could be a good role for him. And when I think of people in wrestling right now who I think would fit and would, you know, be interesting, he's the first name I thought of. Don't know what he's doing these days. Don't know if he could still pull it off. I thought he was on TNA recently. I thought they brought him back for a show, for like a one-shot thing. I didn't see it, but he's the name I would think of. Otherwise, I don't want to see anybody in the role. I want them to bring Dario Cueto back. He's the lifeblood of that show. He works perfectly in that role, and it just would not be the same without him. Fred from Gwythian in Cornwall, UK. I went back and watched the January 4th, 1999 episode of Raw because I wanted to see Mick Foley's WWE Championship win. But something else from that episode happened, which confused me. At the beginning of the show, Shawn Michaels realigned himself with D-Generation X, and among other things, he alluded that he was going to bring Stone Cold to the arena that evening for a confrontation with Vince McMahon. Then, just before the main event, he was betrayed by DX and Triple H when they set him up to be assaulted by the corporation and smashed through the windshield of a car. But then during the main event, DX came out, still as babyfaces, to help Mankind. I wasn't a fan at the time, so did I miss something that happened after the fact, or is it as confusing as it seems? Yeah, it's a weird one, because it's almost like an angle they never followed up on. It was one of those loose ends that never really got tied up. So I went to the network. I wanted to go back and watch it just to refresh my memory about it, because I remember them finding Sean all bloodied up in the parking lot, you know, laying on top of the car. But I couldn't really remember all of the kind of the build up to it and what happened right before. And it's interesting to go back and watch it because, yes, Sean had been the commissioner. He had gone heel. He had actually turned on DX. If you remember that, he had whacked X-Pac in the head with a chair. And so that had happened in the past. And now Sean all of a sudden was a babyface again. And he was realigned, like you said, with DX, reunited with DX early in the show. So the segment right before the main event, and it's actually right after, there's a hardcore title match that I love. Between Road Dogg and Al Snow, where they brawl out into the snow. There's like snow flurries falling, and Road Dogg gives Al Snow a pile driver on like a wooden pallet and wins the hardcore title. I miss those old hardcore title matches so much when they would brawl to the back and they would brawl out of the building and into the Mississippi River. I miss those days. But right after that, they show DX and Sean. They're walking backstage. They're walking to like an exit door. And I guess Sean is getting ready to leave. And Triple H hands him the car keys. And Sean, I think Sean said something to the effect of, I'll see you guys soon or whatever. And he goes to leave. And Triple H sort of mutters under his breath, you know, maybe, maybe not. And then X-Pac mutters, you know, what goes around comes around. And they walk away. And we see Sean trying to get into the car, but Triple H gave him the wrong keys. The keys don't work. So he goes to walk back to the door, and now he's locked out of the building. He's banging on the door. Hey, guys, you locked me out of the building. And then there's a voice. Sean turns around, and you can't see who it is. It's obvious, though, it's the corporation, because they had promised to, you know, to beat up Shawn Michaels. So you see Sean get kicked in the gut, and then the cameraman or the camera falls, and all you can do is hear what's going on in the background. You don't actually see the attack. And when they come back from commercial, I mean, this was pretty brutal stuff. I mean, Sean is laying face first in a smashed windshield on this car, blood all over him. It's actually a great visual because Sean is laying there covered in blood, the broken windshield, and the snow is falling. It's just this great visual. So anyway, they strap him to the gurney and they cart him off in an ambulance. And it was never really followed up on after that. It's almost like it never happened. Now, the reason they did that, if I remember correctly, I think they were writing him out because he was having back surgery, so they needed to get him off of TV. So that was the nature of why they did what they did, but it comes across to me like they were planting the seeds to set something up for Shawn Michaels and Triple H. Like, they thought Shawn might come back at some point, and then we'll do something with him and Hunter, but it never went anywhere. Now, I know that a couple of years later, Sean was supposed to come back and do some stuff, and, you know, he was in no condition to perform, and it was actually Triple H who, I think, kind of raised the fuss and got him sent home, and there was a rift for a while between Shawn Michaels and Triple H because of that. So that came later on, but I don't know if it was just one of those angles, you know, like a Russo thing where they just did it because they wanted to do it, and they didn't have any plan where it might go, but absolutely, you go back and watch it, and it was DX sort of getting their revenge on Sean. I guess for Sean turning on them, this was payback. And they knew that they were feeding him to the wolves. They knew the corporation would be waiting, and they were. And they beat the hell out of Shawn Michaels. Now, you think ahead to what happened in 99 a couple months later, right? Triple H ended up joining the corporation. Triple H and China both ended up joining the corporation. Now, maybe I'm looking too deeply into this, you know? Doesn't really explain why X-Pac and the rest of them would have gone along with it because they didn't join the corporation. Triple H turned on all of them. But you wonder, oh, you know, in storyline, did Triple H know? You know, was he already in cahoots with the corporation when he basically, you know, handed Shawn Michaels to them on a silver platter by handing him the wrong car keys? I'm probably giving this angle more thought than they did at the time. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it was confusing, it didn't really go anywhere, but I think it was just DX getting their revenge. And them coming out as babyfaces at the end of the show, it's not like it didn't make any sense. They didn't do anything to turn heel. You know, it was still a pretty subtle thing that I don't know fans in the building would have even picked up on. So, I mean, them coming out as babyfaces, it's not like that didn't make sense. But it did feel like, A, revenge on Sean for having turned on them previously and made their life hell for a while. And B, like they may have been trying to set something up for Sean and Triple H down the road that just never materialized. Luke from Arizona has another Shawn Michaels question here. In 1993, Shawn Michaels was suspended for being on steroids and refused to surrender the Intercontinental belt to the company. With the previous firings of Sid Justice, British Bulldog, Ultimate Warrior, and the absence of Hulk Hogan in 1992, plus the looming drug trial, why wasn't Shawn Michaels fired for not only failing a test for steroids, but also for not relinquishing the belt when he was stripped of it? I think Shawn to this day, and if you read his book, let me know what he says about it in there, if he even addresses it. But to this day, I think he disputes that he ever took anything. I think he denies that he failed for steroids or that he took steroids. But they don't suspend guys, let alone one of their champions, unless they have a good reason to do so. It's not like some sort of conspiracy theory. They're out to get me. He failed the test. That's not an accident. You know, it's hard to dispute a failed test. Plus, when he came back, if you look at his physique, end of 93, early 94. I mean, he wasn't gone for that long. He really was only gone for maybe a couple of months. But when he came back, he definitely leaned out, which may be proof of nothing on its own. But I look at 1993 Shawn Michaels as baby fat Shawn Michaels, like chubby Shawn Michaels. And the baby fat was gone when he came back. Now, maybe he was just working out, right? He had nothing better to do. He was at home, so he was doing a lot of cardio, you know, getting his weight down. Maybe that's what it was. But I would imagine that Vince didn't just want to get rid of him and allow him to go to WCW. That's why he didn't fire him. I mean, and for a first-time failure, I doubt that, you know. I don't think a first-time test failure, if that was his first time failing, would have been a fireable offense. I also don't think Warrior and Bulldog were necessarily fired for failing a test. I think it's important to make that distinction. The story that I had always heard, and I think Bret Hart talks about this in his book, and as far as Bulldog goes, I mean, Bret would know because Bulldog was family. The story is that they both got popped for receiving shipments of human growth hormone from some pharmacy in the UK. So, you know, and there's no test, at least there certainly wasn't back then. There's no test for HGH. It's not like, well, the Ultimate Warrior failed a test for human growth hormone. There was no test, you know, and I don't think there still is any really, truly reliable test for HGH. I mean, they claim there is or they're making progress, but to this day, I don't know that there really is truly a reliable HGH test, let alone back in 92 or 93. So I'm not sure how they would have failed for that. I think that was just shipments from overseas, and once that was discovered, they got rid of the two of them, because God knows what else they probably were putting in their bodies. But that's very different from Shawn Michaels failing, you know, one test for, you know, for steroids. Alberto from Laredo, Texas, buy or sell on which WrestleMania loss hurt more, Triple H beating Booker T at WrestleMania 19, or John Cena beating Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania 30? Well, you know, Bray never fully recovered from that loss. I don't care what anybody says. He was never the same after that. If you're asking me which match hurt the loser more, then I'm going to buy all day on Bray Wyatt against John Cena. The Booker T loss is more infuriating when you look back. The racist overtones of the story, I thought, were such that he should have gotten his comeuppance at some point on Triple H, and he never did. You know, and the 30 seconds, I know I sound like a broken record with this, but the 30 seconds between the time he hit the pedigree and the time he pinned him, please, please, please go back and watch the end of that match. I know some people are going to say, well, Triple H, you know, so what? You know, he retained his title. The champion doesn't always lose the title at WrestleMania. Or, you know, Booker T wasn't over enough to be the world champion, which I think is also ridiculous. But forgetting all of that, just please watch the end of that match. And the way the WWE has always done spots like that and has always done, you know, matches, even to this day, watch what happened in that match when he pedigrees him. From the moment he does that, they're both laid out, the length of time that goes by. And then if I remember, he didn't even like hook the leg. He just put a hand on his chest and Booker never kicked out. One pedigree, one and done. It was so insulting the way that they did that Booker should have beaten the fuck out of him for that after the match. Like, backstage through the curtain, boom, just drop him. But think back to the year that Bray was having in 2014 up until WrestleMania that year. Okay, he had a great match at the Royal Rumble. To me, the best singles match of his career, even to this day, was that match against Daniel Bryan. And he beat Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan, who was the hottest thing in the company at the time, and he beat him. And then the very next month, he has maybe the best overall match of his career. Because if the match with Bryan was the best singles match of his career, this may have been the best match of his career. In that first six-man tag match against The Shield at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view, which he also won. So that's two fantastic matches in the first 2 months of the year, both of which he won. That's pretty good, right? That's a hot start. Then he gets a match with John Cena at WrestleMania. That's a big deal. And then he loses clean in the middle. For what? For what? To get to a three-match program that would ultimately end with him losing again? I mean, that WrestleMania match should have been a statement about the future. About his future. People have said Bray Wyatt could be or could have been the next Undertaker. And look, there will never be another Undertaker. You know, when you compare these guys to guys from the past, I don't think people realize how much you're really screwing these guys over. You're really handicapping them. You know, Dean Ambrose, when Dean Ambrose was at his most popular, there were people saying he's the next Stone Cold. And it's like, ugh, what are you doing to this guy? There will never be another Stone Cold. Dean Ambrose sure as hell is not going to be the next Stone Cold Steve Austin, but he could be Dean Ambrose. He could be a big star as Dean Ambrose. Why does he have to be Stone Cold Jr.? Why does Bray Wyatt have to be Undertaker Jr.? You're already handicapping these guys by making those comparisons, but what people were saying, and I understand why they were saying it, is that there's no other character that even remotely resembles the Undertaker character as closely in the modern day as Bray Wyatt, at least in this company. I can't speak for other companies, but in this company, yeah, Bray probably would be the closest to this sort of magical, mythical, character that The Undertaker portrayed for so many years. And he could have been something special. He was on his way to being something special. The year started out so promisingly with those first two pay-per-views. And then it all went to hell. And yeah, he's had some good matches with Roman Reigns. And he got a month earlier this year where he was the WWE champion before another inexplicable WrestleMania loss. That one maybe even more inexplicable than the loss to Cena. But when you look at what they did with the WWE title after that, it's even more appalling. I'm talking about what happened earlier this year. Right? I mean, they got the title off Bray Wyatt just to move him over to Raw and to put the title on Jinder Mahal. That was their big plan in taking the championship off Bray after a month. You know, there's a reason I call this guy the Eater of Pins. But just remember, there was a time where he looked like he could be a much bigger deal than he turned out to be. It didn't have to be this way. But I trace it all the way back to that first loss to John Cena. Sam from Lebanon. I was watching an Owen Hart Shawn Michaels match where Shawn passes out and the EMTs and Vince McMahon come to the ring. Was that a work? Yes. Yes, and it was actually a very well done work. I remember watching that live, and I thought it was real. I mean, I was young and stupid, but see, now I'm older and stupid. But no, I bought into it. A lot of people bought into it. I remember going online on, I guess back then it would have been America Online, and I'm like searching around like, oh my God, what happened? Is this real? Is he okay? Is he dead? That was the same night that WCW gave away the first Hogan-Sting match on TV because they were freaked. I think they lost to Raw in the ratings the week before, and Eric Bischoff and them, they lived and died by the TV ratings every single week. So I think they did. I think they lost in the ratings the week before. And so they put together the first ever Hulk Hogan-Sting match, just threw it out there for TV the very next week. And that was a really, I know I'm transitioning away from what your question was, but that was a really weird period for Hulk Hogan. Like, he came out of the crowd for that match wearing a black, like, Phantom of the Opera mask for reasons that are still unknown to me, because he took it off and threw it away, and that's the only time I ever remember him, like, wearing it. He was all decked out in black. So he looked like Hollywood Hogan a full 8 months before he actually became Hollywood Hogan. He had no mustache. I think they had shaved it off in an angle on TV with the Dungeon of Doom or something. And on top of that, Hogan was booed out of the building when he came out. The crowds had grown completely sick of this guy long before he turned heel, which is why I laugh when I hear people like Eric Bischoff in interviews talking about how we had to really work hard to convince Hogan to do this and at Bash at the Beach, do the turn and go heel, and he didn't want to do it, and he had reservations. I can understand Hogan having some reservations, but this idea that this was a last minute decision and it was such a big thing to ask of him. The guy was getting booed out of the building on most weeks for a year before that. Give me a break. The writing was on the wall long before he turned heel that this guy should have gone heel. It was not a hard decision to make at all. Hogan knew that. He's not a stupid guy. You can say a lot of things about Hulk Hogan. He's not dumb. He's made dumb decisions, but he's not a stupid guy. You don't get over and stay on top and play the game and win the game as much as Hogan did over the years for being stupid. He didn't luck into that. He didn't fall into that, okay? He knew what he was doing. He was a smart guy. He could see the writing on the wall. He could read the tea leaves. And so I can't imagine that the decision for him to go heel was keeping him up at night and he was breaking out in cold sweats. Give me a break. Give me a break. So I doubt they had to pull his arm too hard to get him to do the turn. Because you go back and watch, and even that night, Hogan versus Sting, the fans were already turning him. They were making the decision for him. Really wasn't that hard. Randall from Juneau, Alaska. Buy or sell New York hot dogs or New York pizza? I can't even eat pizza anymore, and even I know the answer is always New York pizza. Clayton has a buy or sell. Jake the Snake from Heroes of Wrestling or Jeff Hardy from Victory Road 2011? What exactly am I buying or selling? You've got to be more specific with these questions. What exactly do you want me to buy or sell here? Who was worse? They were both an embarrassment. But just because that Heroes of Wrestling show is probably the worst show ever made, I'll buy on Jeff and I'll sell on Jake. I can't buy anything associated with that Heroes of Wrestling debacle. It's just impossible for me to do. What else did I want to talk about here before I... Oh, all right, Die Hard. So before I end here, many of you, if you follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster, you might have noticed that I posted a question the other day, and this was spurred on by some debate that I saw on Twitter among some movie writers. I guess this comes up every single year. I wasn't aware that this was even a question, but apparently it is. So I put the question to you guys. Is Die Hard, the original Die Hard film, a Christmas movie? Because I think, absolutely, it's a Christmas movie. It's got Christmas elements. It opens and it closes with a Christmas song, right? It opens with Christmas in Hollis by Run DMC. I think it ends with that song, the Corn is Popping or whatever the fuck. So you got the music, you've got the different Christmas elements in the movie. He's out there. The whole reason that the character even goes out to the West Coast, I think, is to attend a Christmas party. And there's lots of Christmas elements to it, so yes, it's a Christmas movie. And then you got the feel-good ending, the bad guy dies and all that. So, to me, there's no doubt in my mind that it's a Christmas film. But I guess people define Christmas movie in different ways. So there was the majority of feedback that I got, and it was almost 200 comments that people left me on Twitter. The large, vast majority were almost offended I even asked that question, so they said yes. But there were a lot of passionate responses that said absolutely not, that Die Hard is not a Christmas film. It's a movie that happens to take place around Christmas, which I guess it boils down to what's your criteria for a Christmas movie? Does that not make it a Christmas movie? I guess if you have a movie that happens to take place around the holidays, but it doesn't incorporate any of the elements of those holidays, then no, it's not a Christmas movie, but I've always looked at Die Hard not only as being a Christmas movie, I think Die Hard is probably the best Christmas movie ever made. So, I'd be curious if you didn't see the tweet, if you didn't vote, if you didn't, chime in. You could still go on Twitter and chime in, but let me know what you think. I'm very curious to get the wider feedback from people listening to this. Do you consider the original Die Hard to be a Christmas film? I was kind of shocked that this was even a question. I lump Die Hard in, as many of you do, with films like Home Alone and You know, I mean, those are quintessential Christmas viewing. I'll probably be watching it again in a few weeks. I'll be watching Die Hard. I watch Die Hard, Die Hard 3. Not really a fan of Die Hard 2. Can't say I'm a fan. But anyway, let me know what you think. And by the way, when I was in the hospital a few weeks ago, my brother bought me a copy. There's a new, I think it just came out. It's like a Christmas animated storybook based around the movie Die Hard. And it's clearly marketed as like a Christmas book. So there you go. If there was ever any doubt that this was a Christmas film, that should silence all of the doubters. But I was surprised. There were some people who just were very passionately against the idea that it's a Christmas movie, and I disagree. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is the place to send your questions. As I said earlier, voting is now open for nominations in the 2018 Wrestling Radio Awards. This is only the nomination period. I don't know how long it goes on for, but you can vote every day, once a day. Show of the year, you can write in the Solid Monster Sounds Off. You can write in any of the interviews I did this year for, male interview of the year. I would be very much appreciative of that. And we've done very well the last few years. Hopefully we can carry that tradition on. The Black Friday sale on Pro Wrestling Tees, it may be over by the time some of you are listening to this, but if you are listening to this, if you are within earshot of my voice, and it is Sunday, November 26th or Monday, November 27th, the sale is still ongoing. As of or up to 7 p.m. Eastern on Monday, you can get 20% off all shirts in our Sound Off store. So if you've been waiting, or if you want to buy it as a gift for somebody, another wrestling fan, friend, whatever, definitely take advantage. The coupon code is Black Friday. That's prowrestlingtees.com/Solemonster Sounds Off. I'm out of here. I will see you again next week for episode 524 as we wind down 2017. I guess next week will be the first December Sound Off. So we're in the final month here. We're in the home stretch as we wind down 2017. And we get a little closer to the end of the year and the year-end awards, match of the year, and superstar of the year, and most improved star of the year, and all that stuff. I'm sure I'll be talking about that, and I'll have to do my predictions soon for 2018. I feel like I just did my predictions for 2017. It's crazy. This year just flew by. Anyway, be well, stay safe, take care of yourselves. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and I will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. So until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
And there was one moron who tagged me in a tweet. He says, "Marks like everything from Japan." This guy has a picture of The Rock as his avatar, and he's quoting wrestling catchphrases on his timeline, calling other people Marks and Smarks when you've got another man as your profile picture, and you're quoting Psycho Sid. Sit the fuck down with that nonsense. You don't get to sit at the adult table when you spew nonsense like that. Go stand in the corner and face the wall.
Since 2007, The Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster Sound Off.